You're all set? Ready on the right?
Ready on the left.
Good morning.
You're on the left.
I'm off. I got a little push in there.
I'm going to open the January 20th session of the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. And we have a number of LCs that we're going to be entertaining here first this morning. And I'm going to open a public hearing on LC4. And Chana, if you could please give us some background on that bill.
Sure can. For the record, my name is Chana Newell, Chairs Committee. LC4 is the Joint Memorial Urging Congress to pass the Chiropractic Care Available to All Veterans Act. It recognizes the extent of musculoskeletal injuries suffered by service members and the relief chiropractic spinal manipulation offers to veterans suffering from back pain.
Thank you very much. And our first witness is Vern Sabo. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Vern Sabo, chiropractic physician from Albany and representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I also represent the American Chiropractic Association as Oregon's delegate to BACA and serve on the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and I'll be back in our nation's capital next month advocating for veterans. The goal of this memorial is to prompt and to gain chiropractic services for all veterans. In the year 2000, a five-year study was published and reported, which was conducted on 13 different Army bases, comparing chiropractic versus medical treatment, and the chiropractic outcomes were far superior. Subsequent to that, in 2001, Congress enacted public law directing the Department of Defense to provide full chiropractic benefits services to all active duty personnel in all branches of the service. The following year, Congress passed another public law directing the Veterans Affairs to provide chiropractic services to all veterans. That was 10 years ago. Little has happened. The Portland VA Medical Center is yet to hire a chiropractic physician. Treatment on the outpatient level is spotty. I will say that they have a very good man, I believe, in Dr. Jack Dryden in the rehab department, who's trying to do a good job, but with the system he has to work with, it's problematic at best. There's no chiropractic services being performed in the outpatient clinics. Referrals to patients veterans to chiropractic physicians in the field is spotty, intermittent. We talk about this all the time on our statewide listserv of several hundred docs, and there's a real problem. I first contacted the Portland VA in 2008, was given a number of different rationales for why nothing had happened, and that continues. The most recent rationale is that lack of money, of course, but that doesn't explain the last 10 years. So the number one ailment of our servicemen and women returning back from the Middle East are musculoskeletal conditions. It's the number one reason why they access the Veterans Administration and medical services. And low back injuries have the worst return to unit rate of all injuries in combat of 13%. So clearly the current interventions that are occurring on site in conflicts are not working, and we would tell you that because of that, there are more chronic disabilities than really need to be. We could prevent a lot of those. Chiropractic physicians are the primary care providers of spinal injuries. We're the best trained to perform evidence-based spinal manipulation, which is our principal intervention. It is not the only intervention that we utilize. We utilize physiotherapies, physiological therapeutics, but that's what we're known for. We're the best trained, and subsequently why we perform 94% of all spinal manipulation in this country. Just this last month, Oregon State evidence-based guidelines have come out from the state of Oregon for low back pain and low back injuries. The only intervention that our guidelines recommend for non-pharmacological intervention for an acute episode of low back pain, 1 to 4 weeks, is spinal manipulation. This is based on the world's evidence. Only spinal manipulation is recommended. The guidelines also recommend a variety of pain medications during the first episodes. So we get into cost versus benefit to our veterans. Many veterans are also prescribed the same medications and take the same over-the-counter medications. Though the state of Oregon recommends spinal manipulation as a first intervention, less invasive, it is very problematic for our veterans to get that right now. We want to change that. We're hoping that you'll help us with that. Just to keep things in perspective versus benefits to our veterans, morbidity, injury, secondary to interventions, Tylenol, which is frequently prescribed and taken over the counter by our veterans because they have nothing else offered to them, is the leading cause of liver failure in this country, resulting in some 140,000 poisonings every year, 56,000 ER visits, which is a tremendous cost, and some 100 deaths due to Tylenol poisoning. It has an accumulative effect on the liver. NSAIDs, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, Advil, frequently given to our veterans, and either over-the-counter and prescription dosage, result in some 100,000 hospitalizations every year due to complications, mostly gastrointestinal. The cost of that has been projected at right at $2 billion in extra cost to the system, and result in some 17,000 deaths every year in this country, which is horrific. They're also given opioid narcotics. We in Oregon have a real problem. We're third in the nation for prescribed narcotic pain abuse of those narcotics. The state epidemiologist, reviewing statistics between 1997 and 2007, found that the prescriptions for the following opioid narcotics had increased by these amounts. Hydrocodone had increased by 286%. These are prescriptions. Oxycodone, 866%. Methadone, 1,293%. In that period of time, there was also 700 poisoning deaths secondary to opioid narcotics. 53% of all drug overdoses in Oregon are associated with opioids, which resulted in 130% increase in hospital admissions. Now, these are general statistics for Oregon, but this is affecting our veterans because this is a lot of what they're getting. Lastly, just out this month is a study out of Portland VA Medical Center and Oregon Health Science University. The authors are Dr. Lauren Dennison, who I spoke with just the other day. It's basically a survey-type study of veterans relative to trying complementary alternative medical providers, such as chiropractic physicians. In that study, a survey of 400 veterans, 75% said they would try chiropractic. And she also found that in their review of the statistics that those who use complementary alternative medical providers were less likely to have service-related disabilities. And it concluded with, our results support the efforts of the VA to increase access to complementary alternative medical treatment options for veterans. It's been 10 years. To coin a phrase, they need a little bit of a kick in the fatigues. We hope that our conversations with Senator Wyden and Merkley, Congressman Blumenhauer and Schrader are very much in support. They're willing to meet with the director and the governor's office. We've had conversations and getting support there in combination with the University of Western States. So I'm hoping that you co-chairs and possibly individual members of the committee will help and be a part of that meeting when we get to that with this memorial in hand. That completes my testimony. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for Dr. Szabo? I'm not seeing any. Vern, I'm just curious whether you've had an opportunity or anyone else from the association to chat with folks at the VA about this issue and what, if any, thing was their response?
Well, I've been contacting them since 2008, and when I first contacted them, I was directed to multiple individuals. Many of the folks had no idea about the chiropractic benefit. I first contacted the director's office, who referred me to the chief of staff, who referred me to the chief medical officer, who had no idea, and I kept getting just basically foot dragging, is the best description I can give. It's been 10 years. And quite frankly, the profession, we have healing hands for heroes and we have chiropractic for our troops. And we just simply are treating them at no cost. But it shouldn't be that way.
I'm concerned that the those who are uninformed may purposefully be so.
Pardon me?
I'm concerned that those who profess being uninformed, it's purposeful.
Mr. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I don't know, but something...
10 years is a long time.
It is. We have our congressman, our two senators, acutely aware of the situation, and we're hoping that this joint memorial will, with their help, will facilitate the Portland VA Medical Center and following through with hiring a chiropractic physician and also getting chiropractic services readily available in the outpatient setting.
Thank you. Anything else? Not seeing anything more. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on LC4 at this time? Last and final call. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC4. And let's see, next is LC194. I'm going to open a public hearing on LC94.
194.
Did I misstate that? Sorry.
194.
All right. Thank you, Jenna. If you would please give us some background on that.
Sure can. LC194 establishes a Veterans Lottery Fund and directs the Oregon Lottery to develop and market veteran-themed lottery games. Net revenue from veteran-themed games would be directed to the Veterans Lottery Fund and used to fund educational and economic development opportunities for veterans.
Thank you very much. And does it make sense to have a panel? I'd like to call up, please, Jim Willis and General Caldwell. You get to go first. Good morning, General.
Good morning.
Good morning, Director.
Good morning.
Welcome to our committee.
Well, we're glad to be here. Would you like me to go first?
I will. You can self-select, please.
We can self-select.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Director.
All right. Well, thank you, General. I appreciate that.
That's
the first, yes. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to support LC-194, which would establish a Veterans Lottery Fund and lottery games to benefit veterans' education and economic development. Over the last decade, nearly 30,000 men and women from Oregon have served our country at war. As that number has increased, funding for veterans program has not. Many who have served overseas return home seeking the lives they left behind, only to realize that that life no longer exists. To adjust, many seek employment, workforce training, or education to deal with the changes that deployment has brought to their lives. And these wars are not finished. Thousands more service members will continue to return, and thousands more will need assistance through their transition. From the beginning of the conflicts, Oregon has been at the forefront of veterans' issues and policies. The 2008 final report to the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services identified the crux of veterans' issues in Oregon and clear recommendations to fix them. One of the key findings of the task force was that new veterans were not engaging the state for benefits and services. To help deliver education, training, employment, and benefits, we needed to meet the veterans where they were, at the colleges. The finding became a reality in 2009 with a highly successful campus veteran service officer program. And while not in my testimony, I would like to commend this committee for its 100% support of that program and voting out the bill to continue the program unanimously with a due pass. The program helped increase federal GI dollars coming into the state by 90.5%, totaling $87 million in 2010. 1,364 disability claims were filed and 1,540 veterans began receiving their post-9/11 GI Bill. In 2011, this program was eliminated due to lack of general funding. And I might even add, was a victim of Oregon's economy and the shortfalls that we are still experiencing with regard to the state general fund. Establishing a veterans lottery fund would help fund critical gaps in services for veterans programs and benefits and bring vital federal money to Oregon. Thank you for your consideration of this important concept, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. I think we'll hold questions or comments until General Caldwell has had an opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Head of Office of Emergency Management, so we've been a little busy doing that here in the last day or two. But I would concur wholeheartedly with Director Willis's report or his testimony. I think the one thing that we have noticed with our returning soldiers and airmen, without question, is the unemployment aspects of where they're at. The education piece was that that the director mentioned with respect to the campus veteran service officers was highly successful. We gave reports to this committee at one point in time where we had 50% of our people coming back from the 41st Brigade that were unemployed. About a year, year and a half later now, we find ourselves that a good number of those, probably 20-25% of them, did go back to college and went back to school, community college, universities, to enhance their employability. And I think that's herein lies the secret to success. If we can get these people, our soldiers, get them a job, then we're going to be better off as a society and they're going to be better off as individuals. And it ultimately will reduce our costs on the back end of the situation. So this bill, I think, is a way to find, you know, work our way through the woods on this situation. We've had been consulting with the director of the lottery, and certainly there are some issues I think that you probably want to talk to Larry about. But I think by and large it's a policy decision of this legislative body if they want to go this direction. It certainly is a unique way to look at it. We've seen other states that have been highly successful. I think it was Illinois was one. Washington, state of Washington, does a similar thing. So it's not unique in respect to the other states that have done it, and I think they've benefited greatly. Anything we can do to educate, employ, job train, enhance our economic well-being with these solid citizens that they are, is to our benefit as a state and a nation. Thank you.
Thank you both. Very, very, Director Willis.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I might add to what the General said about the success in the other states. Most recently, and within the last 2 weeks, I spoke with the director from the state of Illinois. Their scratch-off for veterans generated over a two-year period just over $6 million. Now, they have more people than we do. So then I decided to check with West Virginia. Their veteran scratch-off ticket generated $3 million. And then I checked with Indiana, and theirs generated just over $3 million. And so it's a choice that people make. But what they all told me was that when they surveyed the customer base, they chose to buy the veteran ticket because of what it did. Now, obviously, everybody would like to win the lottery ticket, but they felt good about their ability to give back to the veterans of their state through the purchase of these $2 and $3 tickets. So that's kind of the background of just three places that we've checked with. Well, actually four. You're right about Washington. But Washington does a raffle, which is a little different.
Uh-huh.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to call up next, please, Larry Nisswender. Larry, good morning. Welcome to our committee. I think this is a first for you.
It is. It is. Good morning, co-chairs Esquivel and Witt and committee members. For the record, my name is Larry Nisswender. I am the director of the Oregon Lottery. And as your staff pointed out, the bill does several things. Directs the lottery to establish games for the benefit of veterans, for education, training, and creating a new fund, a veterans lottery fund, and requires that the lottery revenues be allocated to that fund, and specifies what activities those funds can be used for. So to be clear, lottery is not taking a position for or against this. We're here just to provide some background and information. In recognition of how short the session is, wanted to get as much information in front of you as early as possible for your consideration so you can do what you need to do in an expedient manner. And so you'll see when you get my testimony that at the back of it, and I won't go over it in detail, there's some fiscal impact issues that, just to bring to your attention, because any bill that dedicates revenue or allocates that revenue to these two agencies for these kinds of activities requires some ways and means activity to make that happen, especially where if either of these entities want to have spending authority, which they do, and if they also need to establish or fund shift any existing positions to this fund source to provide program support. So just saying that up front. As Colonel Caldwell mentioned, we have been actively involved in the development of this concept. You know, we sat down with them and had a phone conversations with legal counsel so we could help align some of the purposes for this bill with legal uses of lottery funds, because, as you know, lottery has constitutional and statutory constraints for which those funds can be used. We believe the way this is constructed, it does have that linkage, the education, the training, and the job support. So we're helpful in that regard to get it here. So, and as Colonel Caldwell pointed out, it is a policy choice that you have before you. At this point, many of the lottery proceeds are constitutionally dedicated and then statutorily dedicated, and then those that don't fit those two categories, then the governor and the co-chairs of Ways and Means allocate that through the lottery allocation bill based on the unique fiscal and revenue constraints that they're faced with on a biennial basis. And so, as pointed out in the measure, it does dedicate the net proceeds from veteran-themed games to this program, and so it sort of sidesteps that normal distribution channel that lottery funds go through today. So, Just in terms of just going forward, I can tell from the testimony and your interest, you're wanting to fund a program that has some predictability to the level of funding. And so, as Colonel Caldwell pointed out and Director Willis, some states have had very successful programs with veteran-themed games, and others have not had as much. So predictability of that, you know, is a factor to weigh into this in terms of how much money would be available for these services should the body pass this. The scratch-it tickets levels that probably lend themselves to this product in Illinois and West Virginia, they sell considerably more than we do. Just to keep that in perspective, we have about 60 scratch-it tickets that would lend themselves to this veteran-themed game and two raffles. And on an annual basis, our last year, those 60 scratch-it tickets had an average net proceeds of about $325,000. When you take 60 games, the $19.5 million that we transferred, the average is about $325,000 per game. So that's just a perspective on what a veteran-themed game might produce if it produced at the average. And then the raffle tickets produce slightly more than that. We have two a year. They generally net about $1.2 million to the state. We've tried to do more than two, and we've seen the sales fatigue, and we've seen the length of time to sell those tickets extend, and so we've backed off and just are holding two raffles right now. So point being there, not sure if this passed, we would in fact recommend that we offer a third or a fourth raffle you know, because of what we're seeing. Some states have gone all in and had too many raffles. Their sales dropped, and then they lost the sense of urgency in the sales, and then they ended up stopping raffles entirely. And so we're trying to walk that fine line of maintaining public acceptance, public excitement, and have what clearly can continue to do that. So we sell them at St. Patrick's Day and Thanksgiving Day at this point. So I just put some information in the testimony for your information on West Virginia and Illinois, just so you'd have a little bit of background from the research that we did, just to inform the committee. And then just a little bit about unpredictability. Some of these scratch-it tickets do better than others. It depends a little bit on popularity of the game, and it also depends a little bit on the randomness of the winning. If the top winning prize is won early, unless we have a second chance opportunity for the top prize to be won, we have to pull those tickets out when the top prize is won. And so some tickets produce more depending on when that top prize is won, and it's random. Just in my testimony, the policy choice before you is right now we haven't had a dedicated revenue source based on any game the lottery has since we had sports action a few years ago. And I don't know if many all of you are familiar with that, but that was a game that allowed sports betting. We have since stopped that game. But that fund stream for that was dedicated to higher education. And when we stopped that game, the legislature dedicated some other funds through the lottery allocation bill and a statute to higher education to make up for that loss. But that's the only time we've had a game-specific revenue source. And so this would be a first in that regard. And as Colonel Caldwell pointed out, it does hit that threshold of, well, then what criteria would the legislature apply if future good causes came before you and wanted to further slice out dedicated portions of the lottery revenue? And other states have experienced that once they've done this, and it's just a policy consideration for you, whether it be for cancer, HIV, MS, birth defects, where those types of individuals also need education training and perhaps job support. And so it's just a policy choice that's before the committee is and the legislature in general. And I mentioned that briefly in my testimony. So if it's the legislature's choice to do this, we will do all we can to make it successful and provide the funds that we need for this very worthwhile cause. It would take a little bit of time for us to get a few of these up, but we would probably not add more scratch-its or more raffles. As I mentioned, we'd probably dedicate a portion of what we already do to fulfill the intents of the statute and drive revenue that would be put into this fund. So with that said, unless you have questions, I think I'm pretty much covered what I needed to.
Let me see if we have any. Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Give me a little bit better overview of where the lottery is, similar to what you do when I was on revenue. Is this a flat line on the revenue stream in the lottery at this point? Is it declining at this point? Is it going up at this point? What exactly is the lottery doing as a whole? The individual pieces don't matter as long as we understand what the trend is.
Right. I agree, Coach Rescovell and committee members. Our overall trends right now are really flat. Year over year, if I showed you statistics of where we are last year versus this year, we're within 1% of where we were last year and probably the year before. Ever since the smoking ban and the economy tanked around the 2009, we dropped about 20 to 25%. But ever since then, we've sort of stopped and we're maintaining. So no growth particularly, no huge drops. So when you see the revenue forecast, you'll see minor changes in the lottery forecast as you've seen over the last three or four. So lottery's not presenting you with a negative ending balance at this February session is my prediction, but flat. Year over year, no big changes. The unemployment, the discretionary income of players is not growing drastically with people in foreclosure and other issues. Those things all have effects on people's entertainment choices, and we're feeling it.
Follow up, please.
Now, if we allocate an earmark a certain amount of this funding to these issues for veterans, then who are we actually taking away from?
You know, not directly.
Somebody has to be losing someplace.
Yeah. You know, under the current allocations that lottery funds are allocated on, the largest recipient is K-12, obviously. Natural resources would be second, and then economic development efforts would be third. So those are the big three right now in terms of, for instance, 18% of our proceeds automatically are peeled off to go to the Education Stability Fund, strictly for K-12. 15% next goes to natural resources and watershed enhancement activities. So that's the second constitutional charge. And then beyond that, there are statutory allocations. 1% goes to higher education, 1% to problem gambling. And most of the other allocation amounts. Debt service is a big recipient right now, so that's cut down some of the unobligated, unstatutorily directed amount that's available. Those are the big recipients.
Okay, but who? What do you think will take this away from?
You know, it would be...
Do you have any idea at all?
It would come down to a decision between legislative leadership co-chairs about if the money dedicated from this, and let's just say in round numbers it's $1 million a year, $2 million a biennium, it would come down to a decision by the co-chairs as to what's left of the unobligated lottery funds and how they want to spend it. So I couldn't predict where they would take it out of, but they would have to make a choice absent a growth in revenue that would allow for it to be in addition to versus an offset.
And that's fine. What is the, I don't know if you call it leftover funds or whatever that the co-chairs have to dabble with. How much are we speaking about?
I honestly don't have that with me today, co-chair. I can get back to you with that, but I couldn't answer that today.
I would like to know that. I think that's pretty important. Well, okay, fine. Thank you. And he's a general. He's not a colonel.
Representative
maybe got busted while I was gone. I don't know.
Representative Parrish with Representative Matthews on deck.
Okay. So I'm looking at your notes here, your testimony submission, and on the third bullet point, you know, you talk about the Oregon Wins campaign, public messaging, and I guess I have a couple questions about that, because I think we heard in a different committee that I'm on that the expenditures for advertising from the lottery are somewhere in the $8 to $9 million range. Is that about the right figure?
Close.
The Oregonian put out an article a couple weeks back about how much money as a state we're spending on advertising, and they felt like they barely had scratched the surface, and what they felt like they could actually publish on a conservative estimate based on the numbers they were able to get from DAS and other sources, $40 million a year going to advertising. I don't think they were including the lottery in that, but the immediate feedback I got from people was, you know, why does the Oregon Lottery advertise that we're getting beer cans in Astoria, you know, if with lottery dollars? That doesn't make me buy a lottery ticket.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions I have then is, first of all, is how effective do you really think the Oregon Wins campaign is, and the need to actually then come back around and, you know, have that be a concern with, you know, how do we work in veterans into Oregon Wins? I mean, I think it's an Oregon win because I'm pretty sure I heard that we had soldiers go to Turner this week to help with floods, and I didn't get that call this week because Mark, you know, finished his military last month, so I'm grateful that my phone didn't ring, but, you know, I think Oregon Wins when our soldiers go out and help our neighbors and our community, so I think that's an easy message campaign, but the feedback I've heard from constituents right in the comments in the Oregonian is, immediately was smacked the lottery and said, you know, why are we spending money advertising, you know, that type of advertising,
right.
And so I'm kind of curious, I'd like to hear about that third bullet point.
Sure. So really what the point was there was is the more varied and diverse the money goes to, and maybe smaller amounts than maybe some of the force behind some of the campaigns about where the money is going to, whether it's for purchase of parks or forest lands or job creation. And so it just, not with a measure such as this one, but if the more diverse, if there were many, many, many causes, it just makes that messaging be a little different for the Oregon Wins rather than the focus on job development, purchase, natural resources, education, K-12. It just spreads the message across a broader audience. But no, I totally agree with you. The information that would be out there relative to veterans has an Oregon Wins flavor to it. The amount of money we spend for the Oregon Wins campaign is significantly less than the numbers that you gave me for the advertising budget. That would be like a total overall number. Oregon Wins would be somewhere a subset of that. I think it's closer to it's less than $2 million.
Okay. With a different type of question. So the other question I had is, under the types of things you can spend this money on, we know economic development is one of them. Can a purpose for the funds be like access to capital for small business type ventures that, we have a problem employing veterans in the state. But I think that there are probably folks who fall into that class of, either looking for a job or trying to figure out what their career is going to be, who would be willing to actually, start their own venture if they actually had some access to capital. Does that fall under the guidelines of economic development?
It would be under the Business Oregon, the allocation of funds that they receive for economic development and job development and encouragement of people to start and expand their businesses in Oregon. But that would be outside of our control. We quarterly transfer the money, and then the legislature allocates where it goes. But I think that is an allowable use.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your testimony today. A couple of quick points of clarification on the K-12 education for allocation. What's the percentage of that again?
The Constitution allocation to the Education Stability Fund is 18%.
Thank you. Okay. And you mentioned the smoking ban and the economy, of course, in 2009 having an impact on lottery. Is there any way to differentiate between scratch-its versus video poker?
In terms of the impact?
Yeah, in terms of, you said it leveled off after that. I'm just curious, did everything level off, or did we see a reduction in video poker and an increase in scratch-its or not?
I'd have to look really close to see that, give you a statistic or a percentage. The biggest chunk of that decrease was in video lottery poker receipts of the 20-25%. I think scratch hits was why we consider that dropping marginally, but really pretty stable. Mm-hmm. It's more of an entry level product, and for those that don't necessarily frequent age controlled bars or taverns where the video lottery has to be to exist, so scratch it products are in grocery stores and convenience stores, and so that audience is slightly different. And we didn't see near the drop from my recollection that we saw. The video. The video is the biggest one. And of our total allocation to the state each biennium, which has been over the last three, I think, a little over $1 billion, 70% of that is from the video lottery receipts.
Okay. And then my only other point would be, of course, lottery games are played for educational entertainment purposes only and all those things. But it's only my second term here, but I can tell you that the addiction to gambling and lottery seems to be in this building, in these seats, not necessarily out there in the world. And with that being said, I can certainly see that there'll be angst out there between different groups, different special interest groups that would want to do the same thing. But I don't fault our veterans for trying to find a way to fund needed programs for them. And I tend to support this idea. I would also say I would encourage K-12 to look at the same thing, quite honestly. And I don't want to create more work for you, but I want to tell you this. I think people would like to have a choice where the dollars are being spent rather than us having to determine whose favorite pet project gets the Pet of the Month Club. And so I think, quite honestly, I'm a fan of this. And you did mention in there, in your testimony, which, thanks for the thoroughness of your testimony and your brevity in your presentation, but about DMV as a relation to that. Would there be any way that if a group wanted to, like at DMV, if you want a special interest plate, which, goodness, we could come up with one today and get it past February, not through Terry Beyer, but anyway. but you have to come forward with a fee that pays for the stamp and the, in the startup fee. Would there be any of that associated with this? Would that be possibly something that you might look at so that there's support coming into the door so that you don't get everybody that wants their own? Or what's your thought on that?
I mean, let me just make sure I understand your question. Is it in relationship to us starting up a lottery ticket?
If we were to the scratch it ticket in terms of what's it going to look like, the design and implementation?
Oh, okay.
If somebody, just like the license plates, and I only mention that because you make reference to the, one of the time these have expanded until today, there's 32 different plates. 12 of the 32 are for veteran or service-related themes, which, of course, when you look at the different branches of service, it only makes sense that there'd be a diverse and broad scope. So that was more my question.
Yeah, in terms of lottery costs, if this is, unless some legal issues were raised where this wasn't determined going to be a legally allowable operational charge for the lottery to stand this up, and I don't believe there is an argument of that nature, then this would be a part of our normal operating expenses that the lottery operates on to stand the products up, to gain, get input from others on what they might look like, and then try to successfully launch them, and that would be done with lottery dollars from our budget. I point out my testimony, to the extent we'd have to spend more within that budget to get this going, if it's an add-on to our existing product portfolio, then it could reduce the transfers to the state some. But today we operate the lottery around 3% administrative costs. So 97 cents out of every dollar come back to the state, either in funds for public programs or prizes to the players.
I understand. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. What are we currently transferring to the general fund in Oregon from the lottery to the total?
Actually, it does state in a dedicated fund, in the lottery fund, that it transfers on a biennial basis a little over $1 billion. Biennial.
What was that, 12 million, did you say?
A billion.
1 billion.
A billion, okay.
In Washington, D.C., it's pocket change, and it's our attention.
And I neglected to mention that Representative Boone is with us today by phone. So.
And I can watch you all, too. A little corner of my computer.
Stay off YouTube.
Representative Boone, do you have any further questions?
No, I just couldn't quite. It's a little bit challenging to hear the testimony and listen carefully, but I pretty much so far got it. But okay. I just couldn't hear. I heard a billion. I didn't know what that was.
All right.
A billion. And transferred annually, right?
It's more money coming in. Representative Parrish.
This is not so much question, but more statement. I would not want to compare this to the DMV and the plates. I know it says in here the close example. I would consider that a close example, really, because I only buy a car about every 4 years, so I'm only going to get one set of plates. And then, of course, I got my variety to pick from. And, how often do you go into a 7-Eleven or a Safeway or, wherever that there is a lottery available? I think that, that comparison for how often and what the popularity of something is, when you only have a finite amount of drivers and you have a finite amount of cars on the road and people only change over their cars every, 4, 6, right, 8 years, that, that the DMV is, I don't think, is a close comparison on a product with a specialty.
Okay. Larry, is there an assumption here that an additional scratch-it ticket or whatever form it comes in would not be a net increase in the amount of money that's played in the scratch arena?
Good question, co-chair, committee members. The scratch-it products is a very mature product. It's what was our first product we put into the lottery when it started in 1985. It has a stable group of folks that buy that, and we haven't seen a lot of growth over recent years. So 60 is, it's actually, that's a high number. We've tended to be anywhere from 45 to 60, 60 being the highest high end of that, and I think we did that last year. The number that we put out there is more of a product of the need to turn them over when the top prize is won and get a fresh product out there, or when we see products that don't sell and we want to have another product there that we think will keep the interest of players. And so we turn them over on an as-needed basis to keep the sales steady. We don't think overall there's a lot of capacity for increased sales by adding another ticket into the mix. We have limitations in the space and the retailers that we sell this, about 2,500 retailers around the state, and they have these bins when they're in counters, and there's only so many tickets that can be in place at any one time in the space they provide us. And so there are other limitations. So I don't think you'd see incremental growth in revenue if we said, as a result of the passage of this bill, we'll do 61.
Now, when you launch these scratches, will you do some kind of public information ad?
We do, and whenever we would start something that would be a dedicated theme, such as this one, of course, that would be something that we would want to do to successfully launch it, as we have others.
Maybe there'll be some Legion halls around the state that will help increase sales. I think I know one or two, so. Representative Parrish.
From a technical perspective, so when you implement like a scratch ticket, like, you know, I mean, I buy lottery tickets, you know, like there's a Valentine's Day one. How fast do you turn a game like that? I mean, usually those are available before Valentine's Day. They kind of linger around after Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
But what do you feel is the lifespan of a campaign? Because when you're looking at kind of times on a calendar when you could probably really do this and market it, I mean, you got Veterans Day and Memorial Day, and, you know, that would be kind of, because I know you guys, I think there's a 4th of July ticket out there. And
in the past, there was.
Yeah. So, you know, from a time perspective, from the time you launch a game, get your big prize out there, and then, you know, have whatever tapers off, what's that typically look like in a window for a campaign around a card?
It's a good question. I guess I didn't come prepared to answer it real fast. I can get back to you with that. We do, in short, the answer is it depends on we plan almost a year ahead for the seasons that we have sales planned out, just so we have ticket vendors who produce those out of state for us and have to go through all kinds of checks. So we plan well in advance. The ticket life really does depend on the random chance of when the prizes are won and the length of life. I could get you some statistics that would say, on average, how many days are they out there before, you know, we have to pull them and replace them. I couldn't get that. I just didn't anticipate that question.
Can I follow up on that?
Please.
So when you talk about when the prize is won, so say the prize is, you know, the big prize is like a $10,000 on a scratch-it ticket.
Yeah.
So do you pull those after that's been awarded? Do you have to sell all those to completion? How does a consumer know that prize has been won?
We do keep our website updated so people know how many outstanding prizes there are left, you know, that haven't been claimed on a prize basis, and then also to give us some additional ability to leave those tickets out there as long as they're selling. We have had it on a lot of our games in the last couple of years, what's called a second chance opportunity to win the top prize, so that at the end of the game, we would actually make a random drawing to pull somebody else and double, and in effect give a second top prize. So it does allow us to keep the games out there longer, but only when that feature's been added to the game.
How many hits do you get on that website where consumers are actually looking that, you know, the prize is over? Bought lottery tickets since I was 18. I didn't know we had a website that said spot lottery.
I didn't either.
The serious.
So you've been buying tickets.
The serious.
I'm never going to win.
Representative Paris, when you become a serious scratch player, you will too.
Okay.
Very good. Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess just one more comment. I think timing is everything, and I think that the timing for us to do something is now. And that is because our veterans are on the mind of all of us and all Oregonians. We have troops coming home. In fact, Saturday, the 493rd MP Company from their tour of Afghanistan will be coming through the Portland Airport. If anybody would like to be there, 445 and 715, two deployments, north escalators. But I think we have to strike while it's hot. And unfortunately, I can tell you that after September 11th, had they had a firefighter scratch it, we would have been given and buying new fire engines all over the state.
That's right.
But time passes by. And when it does, unfortunately, sometimes things get lost. We've done it to our veterans routinely. I like to think that this committee hasn't done that. But if we don't strike now, there's a good chance just a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, we will forget about all the sacrifice, all the service. And I don't want to be that guy to do that. So let's, my vote would be, Mr. Chair, that we look into this and we move forward and not use February as an excuse to delay it, but actually use it as an opportunity to act.
Thank you, Representative Matthews. Representative Parrish.
So that's a follow-up to Representative Matthews. If this passes in February, could you be ready in time for this November? If we looked at November and tying that to Veterans Day.
I believe that might be a little too quick based on our planning window, but perhaps after the first of the year. But I wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think thematically it'd be nice to tie it to a time where people are, the media is talking about Veterans Day, and, you know, you got somebody from the White House is at Arlington, or, you know, that's when it is top of mind for people. I mean, I don't know that a January or February introduction of that, there's nothing thematically to tie that to.
If this passed, we would do all we could to see if we could do that.
Okay, thank you.
Larry, are you aware of any considerations whereby an outside organization, say a veterans group, would be prohibited from going out and promoting an Oregon lottery scratch game. Would they be free to just go out and do that, do you know?
As far as promoting
yes.
the sale of it?
Yes.
I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit that.
Okay, you know, great.
We're the only ones that can sell them.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise involved and engaged in encouraging it, you'd want to do it in a manner that would keep the folks that are worried about problem gambling
sure.
thinking you've crossed any of their lines.
Understood. But a Legion Hall that wanted to promote that.
No, not aware of any
okay.
any prohibition on that at all.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Any additional questions or comments? Representative Boone, do you have anything further?
No, I wanted to thank Representative Matthews for giving my speech.
All right, excellent. All right, Larry, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate that. Next, I'd like to call up Paul Evans. Major Evans? Or?
Retired, Major.
Almost, sir.
Almost. Good close, huh, Paul?
But we'll remain major, I'm sure.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, sir. Chairs, co-chairs, members of the Veterans Committee, I am Paul Evans. My address right now is 51711 Southwest Old Portland Road, Scappoose. And I saw this on the agenda and I wanted to come forward and talk about a couple of things that I think it seems to be moving in the right direction, but I wanted to emphasize a couple of points. To begin with, as a free-speaking citizen with no ties to the state, I can actually say what I want now, so I'm going to try to not overdo it all in one time. I'm also a veteran of some operations that you may or may never have heard of, things like Support Justice 4, Laser Strike, Deny Flight, Southern Watch, and Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. And so I was preparing my very formal speech today and checking information, I recognized that on CNN today that we lost 6 more Marines in Afghanistan and the French lost a number of others because of the asymmetrical war there. The reason I mention that is this is a very interesting time for us. The war in Iraq has come to a close, and many of us believe that it's going to only get more interesting in that particular place after our departure. In Afghanistan, no one has a good answer for how to get out of it. We've been there 10 years, and every step forward seems to be a step and a half backwards. However, we can enjoy what the previous speaker said is a flat lottery revenue projected stream, and we can enjoy this downturn in the economy, and we can enjoy these other things that we kind of take for granted as the struggles of everyday life, because for the last 10 years there have been men and women standing opposed. I say that because I want to care, I really do want to care, that there would be displacement of funds for making room in this lottery for veteran services. But the fact of the matter is, I'd be lying to you if I said I did. I think the failure of the Vietnam War was not in how it was fought, was not in its result, but was in truly the way we treated the veterans afterwards. I think that the homeless problem we had in the 80s was because there was no connections. A lot of the veterans that were put on the streets because they had some physical and mental issues didn't get the care they needed because the government and the people found something new and shiny to look at, and they forgot about the sacrifice. I also am a little bit frustrated because I know something that you all know, that the people in this building know, and that in 2009 was proven time and again, that every dollar spent on veteran services comes back in clumps of thousands or more. So if you want the most valuable economic development approach, put it into veterans services. And I say that because there's a top line on that and there's a bottom line on that. The top line is you either provide opportunities, you provide more than you think you're going to need for education and for housing and for transportation and for getting vets into these jobs and into these communities that they haven't been in, or at least they haven't been in sustained for a while. Or we pay higher costs in terms of social programs that have to treat the problem. More suicides, there's entire program is going to talk to you about what they're trying to do right now. More abuse, more drugs, arguably more assaults. We are in a time that we've never had before, and I want to emphasize this because I'm hoping that while this committee has been stalwart in helping veterans, you can talk to your peers and you can talk to your constituents this next year, because this is the reality we're walking into. We've had 1% of the population. I know it's fun right now for everybody to talk about the 1 and 99 and all that. Well, I represent the other 1%, the 1% that actually went when other people went shopping, that went when this country tried to continue moving forward without thinking about the costs of the war, the 1% that is still surprised that there is question about veteran services and question about cutting veteran services at the federal level at this time in our nation's history. We didn't cause the $15 trillion debt, but evidently it's going to partially be borne on the backs of veterans at the federal level. So this is where we're at. We've sent kids and kids that have become men and women overnight overseas 4 and 5 and 6 times. Now, I don't know if you know what that means, but that means if you're active duty, that means you come back and you prepare for a year, maybe if you get that much dwell time, and then you go back into an environment that you know is going to be rough. It's not easy to do that, but that's what you do when you raise your hand and sign the line. For the National Guard and Reserve, which Oregon is a National Guard and Reserve state, as we all know, it's even more important because you try to get back here because you're not active duty. That isn't your 24/7 everyday paycheck. And you try to maintain the job that you used to have or try to keep the business that you started or finish the school program that you were supposed to get finished so you could have that better life for your family and your children. And that's what we've done. We've relied on that same 1%. And despite all the discussions that the active duty got big and all this other stuff, we're not talking that the active duty really got that much bigger during the war, about 70,000 full-time spots. That's not a lot to fight a decade-long war in 2 theaters. So here's kind of where we're at and where I'm at. First, there's an organization called 21st Century Veteran that I'm going to be talking to Representative Matthews about later, and we're prepared to try in the 2013 session and the ballot, if necessary, to actually try to get 2% of a dedicated funding of all lottery funds. Now, we won't do that if a bill like this passes through the legislature and we can get dedicated funds. But the fact of the matter is we cannot let the gains made be lost. And the fact that we've lost the Campus Veteran Service Officer program is an absolute, in my opinion, a moral collapse. Because that is a nexus to get people back into the system. And every day that we don't have that, I think that we are actually digging a bigger hole for ourselves. The second piece that I want to emphasize is that the federal government does not have the capability, or at least for whatever reason, is walking away from their responsibilities in many ways when it comes to veterans. And I know, when you're talking in the caucuses, that people will say, well, veterans isn't a state issue, it's a federal issue. Well, that may be. But the veterans live in your communities. The veterans that are coming back, and again, we're not just talking National Guard, there's about 300 to 400 vets that come back to Oregon every month from the active duty side, the reserve side, and the National Guard side. This is an iceberg we see coming. Now, if we're smart, and if we're committed and if we're really engaged, I think we can actually turn this into an opportunity. There is a significant amount of money available from the federal government that is tied to state-driven outreach, state-driven programming. But the choice is yours. We will not have a second chance at this. Several years ago in 2009, we talked about the window closing. Well, I'll tell you right now, if you look at the budgets in D.C., the window's almost shut. So this is our chance, and in the strongest possible way, I ask you to consider this bill in the strongest possible way. I ask you to make sure we don't make the same mistake we made after the Vietnam War. What you did in 2009, the package you pushed through, is historic. But it will be lost if we don't find a dedicated revenue stream to continue the work, because those veterans aren't all back yet. And even those that are, you're still looking at a 24 to 36 month window while they can fake and kind of get through every day until they realize, I actually need some help. So I'm asking you to answer the better angels of your nature today. I'm asking you to make this happen as soon as possible. And I'm also asking you to be ambassadors to tell other folks that this isn't a zero-sum game. This isn't just taking money away from K-12 kids or from other programs. It's a way to bring other federal resources into the state. It's a way to make sure that we have programs in place that prevent the kinds of problems that we haven't seen for a long time. And then at the end of the day, it's the morally right thing to do. That's all I have to say. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Paul, for your testimony. I totally agree with you. But you said something that I guess I'm not aware of, that we lost the Campus Vets Officers Program. Can somebody address that?
Co-chairs, co-vice chairs, members of the committee, I understand that in the 2011 budget, there just wasn't enough money to make it happen. And, you know, ODVA has a budget that has been squished and pulled and pushed as much as it could. And when we first stood up the CVSO program, when I was working with Governor Kulongoski at the time, we knew it was a short-term fix because we only had general fund or program funds to do it, and we needed general fund to fill in. And it's my understanding that that didn't happen, so the program had to be suspended. We never actually had the chance to fully, that's the other thing, we never actually had the chance to fully fund that program. The funds that, and the success that Director Willis is talking about was with five CVSOs. The plan was to have 18 to 24 CVSOs. Imagine the funds, imagine the opportunities, imagine the difference in the lives of vets and families if we would have actually funded the full program. And with this program here, taking lottery funds, a dedicated source, we can actually do the right thing there. So I hope that answers your question, Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, okay. I thought it was something I missed there. I didn't know about that, not being fully funded. Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Paul, thank you very, very much for your very forceful statement. Thank you. With that, is there anyone from the audience or with the public that would like to testify on LC 194?
I actually use a campus VCO.
Please come forward.
Hello.
Welcome to our committee.
Hello. I'm actually a veteran advocate of the state. I'm Tina Olson. Pretty much everybody knows me here, but I actually am getting back to college myself with PSU. I'm one of the veterans that cannot get post 9/11. So at this point, but I'm very active in the colleges with PSU, Clackamas Community College. He is correct. The campus VCOs did get cut. And it was a vital part of the lifeline for these education benefits. Because if you don't understand, when they get back, they automatically go to the colleges and get certified. But it's that campus VCO that gets them started. And they have no idea what they're eligible for whatsoever. And if we don't get these veterans organized to where they're productive of working for their future, they're going to be sitting around watching TV, twiddling their thumbs, and you're going to have a bigger problem. And I am the one that has suffered PTSD. But I've really never testified before, but VSOs are my passion. They are the lifeline of our veterans. They actually saved me. I was hospitalized for PTSD. I don't like talking about it very much, but took a bunch of pills. But Rick Rutherford in Clackamas County saved me. So
we have a somewhat of a tradition here in this committee that we ask the veterans that appear before us what branch of the service they served in and whereabouts. And if you would like that opportunity, we would be honored.
Served in the Army. Mm-hmm. I am a product of MST, mm-hmm. PTSD. First tour was in Camp Casey, Korea, which a lot of people don't know. Straight on the DMZ up there. At that time, I suffered the MST. The Army had forced me to have an abortion. 6 months, I was raising a child as a single mother, and went straight over Desert Storm. So, and then I got sent back and did a tour in Somalia. So I've seen it, done it. I talk to these kids every single day in my life. I do this for free. Everybody knows this. And I have no agenda. But I try. In fact, I just testified in front of the Clackamas Community Commission Board. They were wanting to cut a VSO down there. And thank God they just added the third one because of my testimony. People just don't realize what these VSOs do. Everybody thinks it's a service. It's not a service. It is a vital part of keeping these kids off the streets and not getting them into drugs, not getting them in, and they go end up in jail systems. I mean, domestic violence, everything is risen because of the VSOs. If you go into a VSO today, you have to wait 6 weeks. And I tell them, if I want to kill myself, guess what? I have to wait 6 weeks. Where is the problem there? If you go into DHS, you go see a counselor right away. You go into the VSO, no, you have to wait 6 weeks. It's wrong. And that's where I stand. I'm passionate. Sorry.
Tina, thank you very much for that very compelling story from your vantage point. I, too, although having never utilized the services of a VSO, felt very strongly that the services that they provide are absolutely critical to our returning vets.
Yes.
Yet when we had hearings on this subject, there were some, and I want to stress it was a very limited number of folks in the community who testified before this committee that they were not in in support of the CVSO program. And I would just ask that folks such as yourself who have such a compelling statement reach out to the entire community and try and educate them on the importance. I think to the extent that we have a united voice that comes before this committee, and I know that's exceedingly difficult with anything that we would attempt to do, but to the extent that we have close to unanimity in the statements that are presented here would be exceedingly helpful. And I frankly was troubled. I remembered distinctly by one witness who appeared here in essence said that what happened at the campus level was in essence taking away from other VSO opportunities, and I just think that we have to view this as providing necessary services at the point that veterans are able to engage with a VSO officer, and in this instance, it's at the campus level. So,
it's very, and I am very active in this state. A couple of you know me, but
and we know that you are. Thank you. Thank you very much. Other additional questions or comments from Ms. Olson? Yes, Representative Matthews.
I just want to thank you for your testimony. Thanks for the courage to tell us your story, and thanks for stepping up for the Veterans Service Officers being one on the campus. Also, that of course, you know, your testimony is in favor, of course, of the dedicated lottery fund scratch and ticket, I would imagine. And again, I just really appreciate your time, and hope that you can continue to be an advocate, as you always have been, for veterans and from one veteran to another. Thanks for your service, and thanks for all you're doing.
Well, I mean, just the thing, I've just been put on to, the governor appointed as the military fast force for military families.
Wonderful.
So,
congratulations.
So,
Representative Parrish.
So I had the pleasure of meeting Tina last year at Darlene Hooley's Veterans Scholarship fundraiser, and you know, I sit on four committees, and my other three committees are always packed, and there's always a bunch of no offense to the lobbyists in the room, but there's always a bunch of paid lobbyists in there out there doing their thing with their you know, their interest, and everybody's got their hand out, and you know, this room is continually empty by and large.
Yes.
You don't see veterans come and ask us for a lot. So the things that we know need being done are because we know they need to be done,
yes,
and not because veterans come to us with their hand out and ask.
Yes.
And, you know, Tina helped with the Military Child Education Coalition Conference that happened in this state in October, and those engagements are going to be happening around the state as we get out and reach out into communities. And so she's very involved in that work. And you know what? Just on her own time and her own dime, and I think that that matters. I think it brings a lot of validity when somebody comes up and they're doing it out of their heart,
yep,
and nobody's writing them a check to do it, and they're just here doing it, yep, and engaging with the legislature, and I think that that, you know, brings a lot of weight to somebody's testimony when, yep, they're just doing it out of the goodness of their heart.
So I have not received a dime.
Very appreciative of the work that you do.
Thank you, Julie.
For veterans in Oregon. So thank you.
Well, I want to thank you guys, too, for this. This is an awesome event. I mean, like you said, it's historic. You know, and we had the transportation bill, you know, a couple of years ago, and that's historic. But this is historic.
Tina, that was a very forceful statement, and I hope that this is not the last time that we hear from you.
No, this is not the last time. Actually, sometimes I'm a pain.
Thank you very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on LC-194 at this time? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC-194 and open a public hearing on LC-195. Shanna, would you please give us the background on that?
Right. LC-195 requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to notify the Director of the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs if a member of the Uniformed Services files a complaint with WOLI or submits written evidence of discrimination based on military service.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to call up, please, Jim Willis and Kate Newhall. Welcome to both of you.
Okay. Ladies first.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Swit, Co-Chair Escobal. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm here today with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We're here to testify in support of LC-195. As you all know, we're the agency that's responsible for the enforcement of our state's employment protections for uniformed service members and our veterans' preference hiring laws. Essentially, LC-195 will codify in law a practice that we have right now to refer our civil rights complainants that might be service members over to the Department of Veterans Affairs so that they can assess if there are services or benefits available to them that that particular person might not be aware of. How the process works at WOLI is we have on our intake form a simple checkbox question that asks if the person filing any type of civil rights complaint, whether it be one of the employment protections specifically for service members or something more discrimination, sexual harassment, we ask every single civil rights complainant. If they say they're a service member, the next box is if they want us to refer them over to the Department of Veterans Affairs for this sort of assessment and if there's things that are available to them, and then we refer them over. We have to date referred about, we started this process in summer of 2011, and to date we have referred about 15 service people over to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they tell me that about half of those have elected to receive services from them. So I think it's a really good process. It gets folks who might not be aware of the great services that they provide over to them so that they can begin assessing that and getting those needs. We also appreciate Representative Matthews' leadership on this issue and introducing this legislation. It was very similar to, identical to legislation last session that we supported and actually inspired this informal referral process. So we're happy to see it codified in law. And with that, thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I think Kate's testimony is almost identical to mine. So I will simply tell you this is a great relationship. It has worked well, and as you know, in addition to BOLI, we also have these same relationships with other state agencies and do referrals. And to give you an example, I had a little trouble the other day with my gas card on a state vehicle, and I was at the state motor pool. So I went into the office, where I've rarely ever been, and right on the counter was the veteran referral cards. Great big letters, and are you a veteran, and please fill this out, and we'll send it to ODVA, and so on. So not only does this formalize our relationship with BOLI, which is very important because of the employment-related issues, but also because people go in there from all walks of life, And when they do, to be asked, did you serve in the armed forces, and they see that there's another service available, is very helpful, and I appreciate very much what Mr. Avakian's done, and of course what Kate does every day in support of this. And I echo her commendation of Representative Matthews. This is a good bill. This should go forward. Thank you, sir.
Fantastic. It's great to hear two agencies working together so closely for the betterment of the constituency that we're all trying to help, in this instance, the veterans. Thank you both and your agencies so very much for the efforts that you're putting forward. Every bill needs a champion. Representative Matthews, thank you for that. Do we have any additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be remiss if I didn't first thank Derek Bradley in my office. Derek is an amazing mind, Reed College graduate, and he is really taking a charge issues for veterans, and he's not a veteran himself, but he takes this very seriously, and working with your agencies, you've been just absolutely wonderful. I just want to make sure that we all understand what's happening, and because the first question would be, well, if you guys are doing this, then why do we need to do this? And I think that the Labor Commissioner said it best when he had said, this allows us to put into statute something that we're currently doing that's working. And we don't know if Mr. Willis elects to go on later in life, what that relationship's going to turn into. And we'd like to make sure that we set this in statute today to keep working. So to Ms. Newhall and, of course, and Mr. Willis, thank you very much for your dedication to this process. I know the bill had a high number last session, so we couldn't pass it out of the Senate. But it just shows that good ideas can be worked through and agencies work together for the best interest of the veterans. You're doing great job, great work, and it's always great working with both of you. Thank you very much for all you're doing.
Thank you, sir.
I thought there was a committee bill that said that Jim can't retire.
I think we need to get that in for 2013.
I think so, too.
Sorry, Director Willis.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate that.
Anything further for our witnesses? Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Certainly appreciate your testimony. Anyone from the public on LC-195? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close. Representative Boone, you didn't have anything, did you?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC-195, and I'm going to turn the gavel over for the remainder of the meeting to Co-Chair Esquivel.
Okay, I will open up a public hearing on LC-204. We have Mark Sansusi. Is that correct? Sansusi, that was close. Director Willis again. You're up. Anybody else?
Mark.
And Brigadier General Caldwell. Colonel,
would you like to
please step forward?
Okay.
The Navy, they call it a captain's mess. Gentlemen.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, and I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of LC-204. Which would require certain professional licensing agencies to accept military training and education as an acceptable substitute for traditional training. In November, ODVA testified before this committee along with Mark Sansusi from the Department of Defense about the formation of a work group to explore the feasibility of direct licensing here in Oregon. Originally, this concept was discussed during the 2011 regular session. And as you may recall, Senate Bill 275 created a standard way of applying military education, training, and skills for credit throughout the Oregon college systems. During discussions surrounding this bill, it became apparent that the military training and education veterans receive in the armed forces is in many instances equivalent to that of civilian education for similar professions. LC-204 is another step forward in getting veterans back into the workforce by allowing them to use skills and experience they've gained in the military to succeed in their lives as civilians. LC 204 creates the process by which veterans could transition from their military occupation directly into a civilian occupation. We look forward to meeting with stakeholders in the licensing community to discuss the details of how this will work and to ensure the licensing board's requirements are met. The concept is a win-win proposition. Veterans, especially our National Guard veterans, will be given the opportunity to prove their military skills, education, and experience to meet licensing requirements so that they can re-enter the workforce quickly. And licensing agencies will be able to get more qualified people into the workforce, helping Oregon's economy. Thank you for your consideration of this concept that honors and rewards veterans. And I'll be happy, of course, at the conclusion to answer any questions that the committee might have.
General, you want to go?
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, my name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Department of Defense for the four states up here in the Northwest. I'm especially happy to be here this morning because I left Tacoma yesterday in a foot of snow and no power in my house, which is still not there. So I'm thrilled to be here where there's floods down on State Street, but otherwise this is much better than where I left. Based on what Director Willis said, and you have my testimony, I'll just try and hit some highlights from, especially since we were here in November. Last year, in June of 2011, with 1 million veterans unemployed and with a post 9/11 veterans unemployment rate of 13.3 and with an unemployment rate of veterans 18 to 24 of 21.9%, the Department of Defense started asking states and leaders like you to consider state policy and licensures with your agencies to give our military retirees and veterans credit for their military education and training. And we've, in the last year, and last year, four states did do that, including our neighbors to the north in Washington State. So far in this, for the 2012 session, we have 18 bills going in 10 states nationally, considering the things that, the very things that you have before you in LC 204. We are not asking for direct licensure if it is not equivalent. In cases where the regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense and helps our veterans get to where they want to go, even if it's not completely, that's what we seek. We only seek credit where credit is due. Given this problem, given the magnitude of this problem, this issue is one of the top 10 issues of the Department of Defense State Liaison Office. We would make the case that the Department of Defense already has many highly qualified schools that our military folks have gone to, and it training service members in a wide variety of skills and occupations. When state regulators do not recognize or accept the military training and experience, it creates an additional burden and hardship on our veteran. Also, when a veteran is given the credit for those things and doesn't have to maybe endure as much schooling or training, it also saves more billets for those other civilians who may be in some programs on waiting lists. So we're actually helping in that respect. And also, as far as the military training goes, we've all already paid for it with our federal tax dollars. Now, Oregon's home to thousands of veterans and is a desired location for separating and retiring military members who choose to come back and return to live here after their service. A 2010 Defense Manpower Data Center study showed that Oregon had 1,243 military separate or retire back here in fiscal year 2010. I'm awaiting some data, which I hope to have very soon for the fiscal year 2011, so we're more current. So at roughly 1,200 people annually, you can expect that many highly qualified ex-military people will continue to want to sample Oregon's quality of life and choose to live here when transitioning once they leave their military service. I'm frequently asked what other states have done. In 2011, when we passed up in Washington State, passed two bills, one for medical occupations and one for non-medical occupations. That bill became law on July 22nd last year for 14 commercial occupations and 14 healthcare related occupations. In looking at the Washington bill that is considered a best practice by the Department of Defense State Liaison Office, the LC 204 in front of review would be the same. It looks almost just like the Washington work and would also be considered a best practice. And so we would be thrilled if this LC has made a bill and is supported, and we ask your support here as we get into the session next month. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, co-chair, and members of the committee, I wholeheartedly agree with the two previous speakers. I think this has been an impediment to a large extent to many of our returning servicemen and people who have gotten out of the National Guard over the years, because all of a sudden they had to go back and retrain on something they already knew better than, in some cases, than the people that were teaching the courses. So I applaud you for what you've done in the past, and I think moving this thing along will be an excellent, excellent deal for all veterans. Thank you.
Any questions?
Comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great next step, a great addition to Senate Bill 275. And when I started working on these ideas a few years ago, it was one of those times that you kind of think, if I've got the idea, you know, it's probably not new, it's being done, but I did the right thing, and I started asking questions and got the certified smart folks saying, yeah, we should be doing that. And this is a great next step. It seems common sense, but we haven't been doing it, and we need to be.
I'm shocked.
Any other questions, comments?
Yeah. Thank you.
I think you came before us in
November.
In November, and I think I asked then, and you've got bills that are going forward. It sounds like there's a lot of activity between now and then November. So I asked before, I'm going to ask again, what about teacher licensure in that? Are any other states working as looking at the teaching piece, that a lot of our soldiers do a lot of teaching, training, instruction? They're teaching on college campuses. They're teaching in military base settings with folks on a variety of subjects and subject matter with a variety of, we've got 17-year-old kids and 50-year-old learners in that room when you've got a military instructor. So are any of the other states dealing with teacher licensure as part of that direct licensure?
Representative Parrish, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, yes, other states are doing that. I'm intimately familiar with Alaska, where we just had bills drop on in that state, which includes teachers. When you read the Washington legislation, I don't believe it has. It says school teachers. In some states there are, and some there are not. In many of the bills in the 18 bills in the 10 states that are looking at bills, about half of them right now are including teachers for various and sundry reasons, which you can imagine. But I know in Alaska that is the case. And I agree with you as far as the teaching, absolutely.
I look at someone who's taught for, 10 of their 20 years in the service, and then we're going to send them back to get a teaching certificate in the state for $30,000. And are we losing people who are potentially passionate about education and have the skills to get into our K-12 schools and teach kids and impart that knowledge, who are walking away from that because they look at a $30,000 price tag for an additional, when they have degrees. A lot of officers out there who already have degrees who are just going to say, I'm going to take my marbles and go somewhere else and play, and I'm not going to do this. And I think we'll lose a lot of knowledge that could be imparted to kids and a different type of skill set in the classroom.
And Representative Parrish, I will get you some data on the breakdown based on the bills that we already have. How many of those include teacher certification or going along those lines, maybe for the next time and before that?
Thank you.
And please send that to Shanna.
Shanna, absolutely.
And she'll disperse it out to everyone.
Yes, sir, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Boone, do you have anything?
I do. First of all, Mark, I knew that when I was up in Canada at a conference and I received an email from you, and so I just dug it out. And I'm embarrassed to say it's taken me this long to respond to it, but I totally support this and will work hard for it. And I agree, I think we should look at this in some other sectors. And this is, just got an email yesterday or call from my office from a constituent who's a contractor for 40 years and is being asked to take classes from 20-something-year-olds that he could circles around the fact as far as, you know, the experience level and all that. And I know this is a little bit of a rant on the side, but I'm making the point that we really need to look into things like this. And so say we have some veterans come home and they have been working in construction overseas, and we, you know, it just seems ludicrous to require them to take these classes. In some cases, they should be able to demonstrate their experience level and then get on with it so they can get to work, because these classes cost money, they take time, and, you know, I could go on and on, but this constituent told me that he and 20 of his colleagues will not be renewing their licenses to contract in building contractors in Oregon because of some of these new regulations. So I've talked with another representative, Kennemer, in our house, and we're looking into this. But I just wanted to say that this, it would be for me to be able to help our veterans returning in this, because we know a lot of them did a lot of building over there. I don't know exactly what, but I know they did a lot of building. There's engineers, et cetera, and it would be, it's just kind of offensive to ask them to go through this when they get home in order to get back to work. So, enough of a rant, but I do support this very much.
Representative Boone, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, last year I did do some research on Oregon prior to this to this effort, and I know an Oregon statute, and talked to Mr. Steve Sims, and I forget which agency. I have a list of the building trades where they in statute it says they already can give lots of credit for military, especially in the building trades, especially plumbers and electricians, and there's a whole list of those in statute already. And I was actually cited a case of where a plumber in the Navy or a service could come back and with enough documentation and proof could almost be certified almost at the journeyman level based on military. So we were pretty satisfied that that already exists in statute, and maybe it's not commonly known, and or maybe it's been
Well, if you could give me those numbers, that
would be great. I will supply the committee with that information, too. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Comment?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mark Steve Sims is the apprenticeship guy with Boley. Last year, we codified the 40-40-20 goal, and there were some comments on the House floor that, you know, there was a fear that that was just going to be aspirational. And you know, this is another step that really proves that it's we're putting feet to the fire, and we're really putting some legs on those aspirations. That this is another way to get, you know, more people that, like you say, taxpayers have already paid for that training. Let's just make sure that you know, those certifications and degrees are accounted for, and that definitely helps in the 40-40-20 battle.
The other comments?
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may. Again, Jim Willis from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I want to just echo on something that Representative Parrish commented about that I've been involved with a number of years, and that is the professional teaching staff at the ROTC programs at both the public and private universities here in Oregon. These are absolutely professional instructors who are currently in the military and then obviously transition out, as many do. But in addition to that, we also have those same kind of professional instructors at the Oregon Military Academy, located on the campus of Western Oregon University. Excellent instructors, and I've been to some of those classes in the past. And to allow a transition from what I consider to be an already professional instructor, and in some cases professionals, tenured professors of military affairs at the university level, just makes sense to me. So I can't imagine why we couldn't accommodate that as part of moving forward with this kind of licensing. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, and in full disclosure, so, you know, Mark taught military science at Southern Oregon University and at OIT. And, you know, we had folks who, and I took a few of those classes down there. And, you know, as quality as any of instructors, I mean, I didn't take from my husband, but took from Major Conklin at the time. and as quality of any instructor as I was in my the rest of my liberal arts degree. And so, you know, and when you've got these folks who teach on a teaching tour, and that tour can go for upwards of 3 years, some of them even longer, you know, these are folks who, quite frankly, do a fabulous job of instructing, and to not leverage and harness those talents in the classroom, I'm just going to continue to advocate for that.
I thought your degree was conservative arts, but...
But one time there was a movement to certify all teachers in the state of Oregon, including private schools, and I remember the article that came out in Medford was, that means the rogue scholars that teach in private schools need to go back to school to get certified?
That's right.
Let's think about that one for a while.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Gary, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Schnabel.
Schnabel?
Schnabel. William Comer?
Does the self-selection rule still apply? Mr. Chair, self-selection rule still apply, or do you have a preference for who
goes
first?
I think you have the diet. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I put on my necktie this morning. Retired Colonel Comer, semi-retired pharmacist, perennial volunteer, couldn't find it in himself to put on a necktie today, so I will go first.
Yes, since the military does work for the civilians.
My part is really brief. I just wanted to show up and indicate that the bill doesn't create a problem for the Board of Pharmacy. It probably doesn't have a wide application for the pharmacists to license. We license pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, and a variety of outlets, pharmacies, hospitals, pharmaceutical manufacturers. This bill applies to the pharmacist and the pharmacy technician. All of the U.S. states have virtually identical requirements for entry level for pharmacists, education requirements and experiential learning. So although there are a couple of specific instances where this could come into play, it won't create a problem for the board. It has a wider application for the pharmacy technicians because there isn't a common academic requirement or training requirement for the technicians. There's a variety of ways a technician can get in and get licensed in the state. And I think we'd probably all be better off if we had more military-trained pharmacy technicians in our state. They're good. I'd like to say the board has a position of support, but we haven't had a business meeting yet and won't have a meeting until February 14th, which may be too late. So we don't have an official position, but I can say it doesn't create any technical problems, and I'm assuming that the board will be able to support it. That's really all I need to say.
My name is William Comer. I go by Frosty. It's a nickname for my middle name, Foster. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. Denny Doyle is my next-door neighbor, if you know the mayor of Beaverton. I'm a product of Oregon. I'm a graduate of Willamette University in biology, and I've included in the handouts I've given you is a one-page bio. I also graduated from Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, and in order to finish pharmacy school at Oregon State, I was ended up going into ROTC so I could would not avoid the draft, but you know, so I could finish pharmacy school. And I was commissioned as a first lieutenant in the Army in 1968. As a pharmacy officer, and served 4.5 years during the Vietnam era war, and then stayed in the reserves, went back to graduate school at Oregon State, and got a master's in hospital pharmacy administration, and then was deployed to Europe for the 45th Station Hospital out of Vancouver, that is now the 396 Combat Support Hospital. So I've benefited, been a product, and also benefited from the GI Bill and the Oregon Veterans Home Loan, and I can't thank you enough for making those things available. What I'm going to want to tell you is what the military has done in their educational level, and you may have heard this before, but the military is actually the largest educational entity in the world. And I've got a couple of comments, and then I'm going to go through the handouts and then a short video on what's called now METSI, M-E-T-C, the Military Education Training Center in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. It's over $1 billion of construction that that staffed up a year ago in September, and it's the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard Training Center for over 60 technical MOSs, military occupational specialties. They have 7,000 to 8,000 students on campus every day, and they graduate over 25,000 students. And if I may, is it okay for you to tell me what any military VA veterans background status you have, so I don't, if I'm using acronyms that may need to be explained, any of you have been on active duty or in the reserves?
I think that if we have people from various parts, branches of the military, we've never been able to talk to one another anyway.
Well, METSI is, and in the healthcare side of the military, we're talking about purple uniforms now. Have you heard that? Where you have one set of medical personnel from, you know, pharmacists, doctors, nurses, you know, all the technical people would be in one uniform, and they could go to Marines. You know, obviously there's going to be specialty training. But a couple of comments. There is one military now. I've been on active duty for over 5 years and also in reserves. And when we were called to active duty during the first Gulf War, our unit was sent over to Europe, and there was about a 12-week waiting period for people to get in to see a primary care doctor. Otherwise, they went to the emergency room. And Dr. Jeff Burt, orthopedic surgeon down in Coos Bay, was my roommate. And in 1 week, we had that waiting time down to a single day. And we were stationed in Stuttgart, and it was the Eisenhower's headquarters and the J-Staff, and we had a chance to talk to a number of the senior military, the USARA commander and NATO commander there, four-star, and he was absolutely blown away by what the reserves and National Guard could do. At Stuttgart, we had over 250 reservists from seven different units from around the country. In 1 month, we were ready to rock and roll. job cuts in the military. You've heard about it, the cutbacks. That's going to impact every single state. What is about 250,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen are going to be cut loose and sent back to their states, and they will not have jobs. But they're extremely well-trained. And the sad part of all of this is this war is not over. Yes, we supposedly exited Iraq, but the war is not over, and it will continue. There will be more 9/11 attempts. And if we think if we get into the 90s like we did, cut back too much in the military, we'll have another 9/11. So we need to be prepared, and we need to have an active support mechanism for reserves, National Guard, retirees, et cetera, that could be called back to active duty. There is an incredible lack of coordination between active duty, medical, and the VA. And I've, in my 20 years of working with Coram and Apria Healthcare, I headed up the last 10 years, I was vice president of Federal Health Services, and I worked exclusively with the military, TRICARE, and the VA, getting patients out of the hospital, wounded warriors, back home on IV therapy, oxygen respiratory therapy, so they could rehab at home. And going between the military and the VA is just an appalling lack of coordination. Different computer systems, you know, you've heard of the months it takes to get disability ratings, et cetera. So things like that have to be improved. And there's over $100 billion spent on healthcare, about $50 billion in the VA and $50 billion in the military. A lot of that is, of course, capital equipment and facilities, et cetera, but a lot of it's personnel. And they're going to be losing a lot of those people, too. So they're going to be coming back here, and this is what this LC is going to be helping to do. One caution, and I have personal experience with this, and I won't name the country that I experienced it with, and I won't name the states, and Gary knows it, it's New York and Illinois, had a clause where you could take foreign-trained pharmacists, and if they served in the military for their 2 years, this was during the Vietnam era, they could get licensed in those states. And I worked with these, and they were pharmacy technicians at the time. That's the so-called internship that they had. And it was appalling, the culture differences and the lack of understanding of U.S. healthcare. In Germany, I went out into the economy and to get backup supply channels, because we basically sucked out all the albumin from the United States in preparation for the 100,000 casualties we were expecting in the first Gulf War, which fortunately we didn't have. And we wanted to set that up with the German hospitals. And it was back, stepping back into the 1800s. Doctors were doing what our nurses do here. And this was just 20 years ago. And so the equivalency of overseas training, don't, please don't take this LC and automatically license people who haven't been meeting the Oregon standards or, and the military, by the way, for pharmacy officers, you have to be meeting virtually the same standards that that Gary's team have and our Oregon Board of Pharmacy requires, as does the whole country. But there can be some expediting going on. So let me jump quickly to the, it's about a 6-minute video. It's very instructive, and I really appreciate the opportunity that Shanna has authorized us to do. But again, $1 billion, over a bill, about $1.2 billion in construction. This is a state of the art, and I wish our school system could be like this.
Check the sound. We don't have sound.
Maybe you could just do the sound first.
While they're doing this, some of the specialties include what we call 91 Charlies, and I know the director of the Board of Nursing is here, and we had a brief discussion prior to this. Those would be equivalent to your LPNs, your medics, combat medics, lab techs, pharmacy techs, OR techs, X-ray techs, veterinary technicians, 60 different specialties. And we have a saying in the military, particularly the enlisted people, say, don't call me sir because I work for a living. These kids are sharp. When I was on active duty in Vietnam, I was taught how to compound sterile products for inpatient care by a pharmacy technician that had gone to their training. The colleges of pharmacy don't teach that kind of technical stuff.
Still no sound.
Is this like a silent movie?
Yeah. The handouts that I have here, one is an email I went to the pharmacy consultant to the Army Surgeon General. Ricardo Nannini is the assistant pharmacy consultant. He's actually an Oregon State University pharmacy graduate, and so this kind of describes a little bit of the METSI. There's also a description and a couple of pictures that you can see about the METSI. And then also there's a document here from the Institution for Credentialing Excellence called ICE that discusses their accreditation of METSI.
That's it. We got it. Sorry.
All right. We're secure. Let's head out.
When service members are injured on deployment or here at home, they want to know the finest medics, corpsmen, or medical technicians are treating them. Quality care is at the center of military medicine's mission for the Department of Defense and its service members. Across all services, military medicine's goal has always been to train and deploy the best medical personnel to help all service members and defend our country. For over 200 years, the U.S. military has trained medics, corpsmen, and medical techs at their own service-based schools throughout the United States. Now, the knowledge and experience from all these schools and the battlefield are integrated at the Medical Education and Training Campus at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. The Medical Education and Training Campus, called METSE for short, is a result of the Department of Defense's 2005 Base Closure and Realignment Commission. The mission was to create a service-integrated, state-of-the-art military healthcare education campus to jointly train medical enlisted personnel from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard. With that common goal, all four services within military medicine work together to co-locate and create a joint educational facility and curriculum to meet the mission. Today, METSE is the world's largest technical healthcare campus, allowing soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen to train together for the first time in a fully joint medical enlisted facility. Consolidating curriculum, classrooms, instructors, and students allows all services to learn from each other and adopt the highest standards like never before. Instructors from all services work to transform their students into the finest caregivers of their discipline within their respective services and in joint assignments worldwide. The joint training allows medical enlisted personnel to understand the joint environment prior to deployment or at their next duty station. Although most of the training happens in consolidated classrooms, METSE is committed to making sure that each service is able to maintain their identity and sense of camaraderie. Students drill and march with their own service. Each service has their own unique living quarters aboard METSE, and students from each service will come together to learn specific skills and indoctrination that directly relate to their service's needs. Training medical enlisted personnel to the highest level requires state-of-the-art facilities, tools, and staff. METSE's extensive resources provide exactly that. The radiology program consists of two labs that provide 20 live exposure units and 12 simulated exposure units. 15 other simulated exposure units are also located in classrooms on the campus. With the live and simulated exposure units, students are trained on equipment they will use at their next duty station, which is the most modern state-of-the-art equipment. The dental program features 60 dental treatment chairs within four fully furnished and functional general assisting laboratories. Students create molds and work with the actual tools and materials they will use in their future dental clinics. The classrooms and laboratories are also designed to enhance real application of knowledge and skill. A good example is the pharmacy technician program, where two classrooms are immediately adjacent to two fully stocked and functional 12-window outpatient pharmacies. The aquatic center supports the Special Operations Corpsman Prep program and includes a heated saltwater Olympic-sized pool. The training facility trains approximately 30 students per class and 200 per year for search and rescue, dive, and recon training pipelines. Many of the labs and classrooms at METSE are so technically advanced, METSE can serve as a medical treatment overflow facility if other medical facilities in the San Antonio area are ever overwhelmed due to a mass casualty event. METSE is committed to preparing our medical enlisted personnel to continue their education after leaving METSE. Most METSE programs are accredited and include coursework that is transferable to colleges and universities. Graduates of METSE are not only the best trained medical enlisted personnel in the armed forces, but they can pursue a degree program at a four-year college or university if they choose. METSE currently provides over 66 programs in 180 classrooms to over 8,000 students on a daily basis. So every year, METSE will be graduating nearly 25,000 students in support of America's armed forces. In 4 to 5 years, the majority of military enlisted medical personnel will have been trained at METSE, ensuring DOD's integration mission. With this integration, METSI is using the collective experience of all services to train our students to be the world's finest medics, corpsmen, and medical techs, so they can support our nation's ability to engage globally. The Medical Education and Training Campus, METSI, bringing the best of America's military medical enlisted training together.
Thank you. Couple more comments. 95% of our, if not more, of our veterans and retired personnel are extremely employable. There's 5% that we need to take very good care of. Some of the issues have been discussed today already, and we need better VA and DOD coordination to meet those needs. And one of the things that is just, I think, is unconscionable is this anti-recruiting issue that I know the Portland Public Schools have put into place. I find that extremely offensive and deleterious to students that could participate in something like this. I've had a number of my enlisted personnel go on to pharmacy school. My wife and I have personally started a Comer Family Endowment at Oregon State University College of Pharmacy for pharmacy students in the military, and we've had 12 of them go through. We give them a $2,500 scholarship each year, and it is a graduate level program, so it's pretty expensive. And we've got that endowment from personal contributions and also me recruiting and arm-twisting some other people up to $90,000, and it will be perpetual. So there's so much that we can do individually as well as organizationally, and I'm really pleased to see what you're doing is creating an environment to do this.
Any questions?
Mr.
Comments?
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Colonel, when was METSI started? When did it get
open? It started a year ago, September.
A year, okay.
Yeah, and it was in process for about 5 years, building it up and construction and everything. Over $1.2 billion in Fort Sam Houston. And you may have noticed that it called Joint Base, Lackland Air Force Base, which is Wolfert Hall Air Force Medical Center, which is the largest Air Force medical facility in the world, moved its hospital over to Brooke Army Medical Center. And Lackland now has a kind of a mega clinic. So, and the same thing happened up at Madigan with McCord and Fort Lewis.
Pretty incredible. And to answer your question, the greatest represented population up here is enlisted Army 95 Bravo Military Police. So,
yeah.
I'd throw that out. The largest population of would be represented. I'm just saying.
A little free advertising here.
Yeah.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, my colleague so stated. Yeah. All right. So, sir, I looked at the METSI website, actually, and this is right up my alley. I love what's going on at the METSI. I'm a firefighter, and we had pushed
first responder then.
And we did some legislation that actually Oregon requires a two-year degree to become a paramedic.
Mm-hmm.
But we were actually able to waive that in case where we had some experience and whatnot. And one of my frustrations is when we were researching the bill and how far we could go with EMT, we weren't training to a similar standard throughout the military ranks and branches. And I don't see a combat medic on METSI. Is that something that, am I missing it, or is it just not there yet?
It may be named differently.
Okay.
And again, as you know, the Navy supports the Marines. So believe me, those medics that are in the Marine Corps or with the Rangers will have gone through here. Now, again, this is up for a little over a year. So before, it was individual military services training their own. And that was a, you talk about Republicans and Democrats trying to get along. It is amazing. And Walter Reed, by the way, merged with Bethesda Naval. And they have a Navy commander. And things aren't going as well as we'd like to see that from a retiree population. But there's still the service issues, cross-service issues. But what's amazing, and I also take my Oregon State Pharmacy students to the Joint Forces Pharmacy Conference every year so they can see actual people and get some career counseling. They've spent a lot of breakout sessions talking about the coordination both of the Joint bases that have been merging, as well as the school systems. And I see great progress, but there's much to do still. And so I'm sure that and I'd be happy to serve as a resource for the committee, network, hooking you up with people like Lieutenant Colonel Ricardo Nannini, and others that could directly at METSI that could maybe answer those questions directly.
Thank you, sir. And just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. And yeah, because one of the situations I came across was it's different if you're a combat medic. Although you're licensed to give, I guess you'd say licensed or certified to give intravenous medication. Yeah. And so I was trying to at least find an equivalent to at least allow for the certification of EMT intermediate as an equivalent, and then they could go on to get their paramedic if they were needed a couple more classes. But I think there's a lot of different trades we can do that in. And last thing I'll say is I appreciate your comment about Portland Public Schools. I think not allowing folks in to recruit for this nation's military is a big mistake.
Well, they're allowing them. But now they've got this anti-competitive thing.
To work against it, to try to recruit people not to run.
School systems are trying to educate people.
Yeah.
And the military is the largest. I mean, that's 25,000 graduates a year just in the medical side of things for technical. There is no, by the way, pharmacy school in the military. There is a medical school at Bethesda. And one of my patients, IV therapy patients, came back from Afghanistan with a spontaneous osteo, his femur. He went to West Point, went to military medical school, did his internship, fellowship, and residency in orthopedics. And we took him home on 6 weeks of IV antibiotic therapy rather than having him sitting up at a civilian hospital in Seattle. And he had never heard of home IV therapy. So, you know, these are well-trained people, but they're also isolated. And so the civilian healthcare system has become the reserves also of the military healthcare system through the TRICARE benefit. And so that's one of the things I've been working on for the last 10 years.
Great. Thank you for your work. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank both of you for the quality presentation that you've given us here today. You've gone above and beyond, and this was just, as I say, a wonderful presentation. Colonel, I want to thank you for your dedication to your profession and for making higher educational opportunities available to students who just possibly might not have had that opportunity absent your efforts. You're a credit to the military, you're a credit to your state. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It's we can just get them to wear a necktie.
I'd be at BDUs otherwise. Yeah, it's amazing because the during Vietnam, there was only two pharmacy officer slots, and my Command and General Staff College thesis was the justification for pharmacy officers in a MASH unit. I'm not saying it was the only thing that caused this, but you have pharmacists on the front lines now. There was 250 of them in the first Gulf War, and now you've got a pharmacist in every combat support hospital and front lines. And before, you had doctors and nurses trying to do that, drug diversion, all kinds of issues, pharmaceutical care, the clinical management of drugs and everything has so greatly improved. And so all those things are really cool.
Any other questions? Rep Poon?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Good?
Thank you.
Thank you. By the way, the Marines are a small part of the Navy. Remember that.
Yeah. Don't they? Yeah. I wouldn't say that in front of a Marine, though.
Oh, I would.
Navy's transportation.
Yeah, he has said it.
He did say it. We have Eric Griblix?
Gablix.
And then a Holly Mercer.
Co-chairs, for the record, Eric Gablix, the director of the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. We'd like to start by saying we appreciate the service of all the men and women that have worn the uniform of our armed forces. We also appreciate this committee's efforts to make sure that we recognize that service in the regulatory side of our state business. DPSST, as most of you know, licenses and certifies over 35,000 people that wear a different uniform in our state. That is that of a police officer, corrections officer, firefighter, 911 operator. We're very pleased to testify in this bill. We understand what LC-204 does. Our board has not officially taken action on this, but I wanted to share with you it lines up with what we do on a daily basis, so we don't have any objection to what you're looking to do. We do have one change that we would ask. We work with staff, and they have caught the change in Section 27, but we also do need to make one quick technical change in Section 28, and that is replace the name of the board with that of department, which will then fall in line with what we do. So with that, again, we appreciate your efforts today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
You're on, Ollie.
Thank you very much. Co-chair Esquivel, co-chair Witt, we've met before. I've never appeared before this committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm executive director of the Board of Nursing. I am very pleased to be here today. I do have to say, on a personal level, I want to voice my support of the military. My husband is a retired Army officer and a Vietnam veteran. From a professional standpoint, our board has no problems with the current language of this LC. We currently, for our nursing assistants, have very similar language in administrative rule. We do require an additional 400 hours of work experience within the nursing profession. Then the individuals can sit for the licensing exam. It's interesting because we actually have data through our nursing assistant database, and over the last 5 years, we've only had 8 people come in through military training, and only 4 of those people actually got through the standardized test. We look at the Army training that's available for our licensed practical nurses. We currently have 85 active licensed practical nurses that came in and had some military equivalent training. We are very excited to hear that the other branches are looking to a coordinated effort for education. It's very disconcerting to us that the Army actually seems to have taken the lead in the training, and if the other branches can then join in and make it more standard, it makes it easier for our licensing folks to look at it as equivalent training. So we applaud that. We are here in support of this bill. Our board meets in February, but since we already have this same kind of equivalent training in our rules, I'm certain our board will support it. But I also want to offer my personal support to work with the committee in terms of coordinating all the branches and getting one type of training available so that these are not difficult decisions for licensing boards. Thank you. I'm
any
open
questions?
To questions.
Comments? Representative Boone, you have any questions or comments?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, appreciate it. Chair.
Yep. Yes.
It sounds like the Colonel's presentation on METSI is beginning to do exactly what Holly describes needs to be done. I will say that I'm just not surprised that the Army did take the lead.
Yeah, but I'm sure they're going to put an admiral in charge.
Somebody will follow us yet again.
So, thank you very much. You see why the difficulty of getting them together. You can, yeah,
yes.
Okay. So,
thank you
very much
for your time.
Civilian Evans, did you would like to speak to this issue or not?
That's been said, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, with that,
do we have anyone else?
Anyone else would like to speak towards this issue? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on LC-204. Okay, I'm going to open up a work session on our legislative concepts here that we have, and I want to state one thing, that a vote in favor of this doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to vote yes or no one way or the other. It's just to submit it as a bill, as a concept, a conceptual bill. So I'll take a motion on that.
Gavelin on the work session.
I'll open the work session on it.
Mr. Chairman, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-4, dated January 18th, 2012. LC-194, dated January 5th, 2012. LC-195, dated December 9, 2011. LC 204, dated January 18th, 2011.
Is there any discussion? No discussion at all. Co-Chair Witt moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 4, dated January 11th, 2011, LC 194, LC 195, and LC 204. Any comments at all? Representative Boone, do you have any comments?
Well, the only comment I'll make the same as I did in my other two committees this week is I can't vote, but if I could vote, I would vote yes.
So are we supposed to hold that in our pocket for future reference? Is that it?
Yeah. Keep that in mind. I'm making a statement here.
Okay, if there's no objection, is there any objection to these, submitting these as bills? Seeing none, so moved. Will be introduced as committee bill. I would like to say one thing to Holly Mercer. Make sure you tell your husband, since he's a Vietnam veteran, to welcome him home.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on our draft, which are now be bills, and I'm opening an informational hearing on this Cascade Centers, Inc. We'll have Julie Marshall, and would you please come up? And General Caldwell, are you in this mix?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Military Department. And I wanted to give you just kind of, before I turn it over to Dr. Marshall, I wanted to give you kind of a background or just a short synopsis of where we were and how we got to where we are today. As you are aware, we previously had a contract. Federal monies were earmarked out of Congress for a suicide hotline, and we had a contract with Oregon Partnership. It was actually a federal contract. The due to Congress's delays in getting their work done, that contract expired late in the game. When the Congress did finally get a defense bill out, there was a money that was allocated for this suicide hotline, or military help hotline. And unfortunately, because of the lateness of the money being put out, we were required to solicit a lowest responsible bid under a fast-track system. Otherwise, we would have not completed the process and not been able to execute the contract before the 1st of October. We received four bids. Cascade, who's with us today, was the lowest bidder. We had another one from Ceridian, which is a national company, and Zydest Expressions is another national company and Oregon Partnership. Their bid was $103,000. Ceridian was $155,000. Zydest was $242,000, and Oregon Partnership was $499,000. Cascade Centers met all the contract qualifications and requirements for this that we put into the bid solicitation. It was again funded by FY11 congressional increases in that funding mechanism. Wasn't an earmark, but it was close for a new way of doing business at the congressional level. We don't anticipate that there will be money in the FY12 budget. We're looking at internal things that we could use to maybe extend it, but we're seeing some reductions. It may not be possible. We're seeing reductions in our state budget. We're anticipating reductions in the federal budget for reintegration across the board. To date, Cascade has completed every and complied with every task that they had under contract in their contract on time, and they have exceeded they've complied with everything, but they've actually exceeded in five different areas. They've exceeded the requirements that were in their contract. So to date, we think that they are doing a stand-up job of executing this contract that they have with under our federal contracting system. I would add that if the state was to come in and say we're going to extend it, say, at the end of the contract, which is in September, we would not be able to add state money into this contract. We would have to do a separate contracting process. So that would fall under state contracting rules, not federal, so we can't take state money and plug it in. systems. So with that, I will introduce Dr.
That
Marshall.
That is common sense thing again?
Yeah, it's...
I wonder why they call it common sense.
Yeah, really.
It's so uncommon.
It's so uncommon, right. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Marshall and her assistant, and they can tell you what's been going on since they've taken over that contract.
Co-chairs Esquivel and Witt, members of the committee, I want to thank you for inviting us here to brief you this morning. As General Caldwell said, my name is Dr. Julie Marshall. I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm licensed in the state of Oregon. And I've worked with Cascade Centers Incorporated for a little over 14 years now. My title is Vice President of Clinical and Operational Services, which does a good job of saying what I do. I oversee the clinical aspects of the program as well as the overall operations, and that includes the military helpline. And I'm also here with retired Colonel Doug Cool. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Marshall. Chairman and co-chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Cool. I'm a retired colonel with the Oregon Army National Guard, served with the Oregon National Guard for 24 years, 20 of those years on active duty, served with MARC at 41st Brigade for about 4 years. Did tour in Afghanistan, did quite a few foreign projects with the 1249th Engineers, had a great career with the National Guard.
And you work full-time with Cascade Centers?
So currently I'm the Director of Outreach for Veterans with the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline, and I've been doing that since the beginning of this contract.
So as you know, the Military Helpline is a critical program, and I know that's why you've asked us here today, because you want to make sure that the helpline is being delivered by a quality program. And I want you to know that Cascade Centers takes us very seriously. We've been very honored and passionate about providing the service, and I think we've put together a very quality, comprehensive program that I'm going to tell you about now. So a little bit about Cascade Centers. We have been in business for 36 years, providing primarily employee assistance services, so phone counseling, face-to-face counseling, critical crisis intervention. We serve over 250 organizations. Primarily, they're located in the Northwest, but also they're located nationwide. So that's private, public businesses. So one of those is with the state of Oregon. So we've done their EAP for about 25 years. For those of you who are not familiar with EAP, Employee Assistance Program, what that means is we contract and work with various employers to provide our services as a benefit to their employees. So those services include face-to-face counseling. We have a statewide, nationwide panel of face-to-face counselors. It includes crisis intervention 24 hours a day. And it includes a set of benefits we call work-family-life benefits, so really to help people with those things other than your typical behavioral health or mental health benefit that still significantly impact their lives. So legal issues, financial issues, child care, elder care, career, those types of things. And in that way, our mission really has been, since our inception as a company, has been preventative in nature. Certainly, we provide expert care in those times of when there's a crisis, but we also work to really provide those services before it gets to that point of crisis. And I think you're going to see that preventative focus in the development of our military helpline. So we respond annually to more than 145,000 calls. And as I said, that we have that preventative focus as well as that crisis intervention services. So as you know, through your personal experience, through the service members that you talk to, through the testimony you hear in this room, that service members face challenges throughout the deployment cycle, before, during, and of course well after. And whether they've been deployed or not, service members face significant issues. And you've probably seen this list before. These are the top issues that they are faced with. Failed relationships, legal problems, unemployment, financial. For us right now on the military helpline, the top two presenting issues are financial and unemployment. People are calling us both in crisis around those issues and also for resources around those issues, and those are the top two that we see. To give you an example of a call we took, to give you a picture of how we take these calls, an Oregon Guard member called in And she reported that she was having suicidal thoughts. As she was talking to our master's level counselor, the counselor started talking to her about what was going on. She reported that she had a significant argument with her husband and was very distraught over that because she felt that her marriage was ending, and for her, she didn't know how she could go on without her marriage. And as that counselor talked to her and weaved in that suicidal risk assessment, she deemed that she was very high risk for suicide. So she had the strong suicidal thoughts. She had strong intent. She had the means, and she had a plan. Her plan was that she wanted, that night, she was going to go out and drive her car and create a fatal car crash. So the counselor worked with her, talked to her about what those issues were that were going on for her, started to slowly get her to see that there were other options, talking to her about those marital issues, got her to that point of de-escalation where the counselor felt she was safe, but definitely felt that she needed further and right away some face-to-face counseling and ongoing. So what the counselor did, we have an extensive database of military resources. There's a group we work with that provides pro bono counseling services for vets. Worked with their panel, called around, found a counselor who was willing to move their schedule around to get her in. The counselor facilitated that appointment, made sure that that counselor kept the client, the service member, kept that appointment, followed up with that counselor that they were going to keep on with the case, followed up with the service member afterwards to make sure that she was continuing on and got all the services she needed. So, you know, I mean, it gives you a glimpse of how we handle the call. The thing I want to also point out, too, is we do what's called an assisted referral. So we never... especially in points of crisis, just say, even getting the name of that counselor and giving her the phone number wouldn't have been enough. Because somebody in crisis like that, even though she was de-escalated at that point, if she hit any barriers, she could easily have escalated back. And so it's very important that we do what we call that assisted referral and make sure that they get there and then even do that follow-up afterwards. And that's a critical component in our program. All services are completely confidential. It's very important for these service members to feel like they have a place to call outside the military that's confidential. Service members can call in anonymously if they would like to. Certainly there are times it helps to have identifying information, but if they don't want to provide that, that is fine. And in fact, right now, 26% of our calls on the helpline have been anonymous. So we have a dedicated phone number for the military helpline that is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as I said, we have that preventative focus and also working with people, not just when there is a crisis. Certainly that's an important piece of this work, but also helping people with resources. To illustrate that, a recent call, we had a service member call in who had recently lost his job, which was understandably stressful for him. He was calling us around resources, though. He wanted to know how we could help him with resources to find a job. So our master's level counselor, who was talking to him, immediately started to provide him with employment-related resources. We connected him with a veterans employment rep with WorkSource Oregon, offered to review his resume, which the service member took us up on, reviewed that resume, provided feedback. He incorporated that, even asked our counselor to review that, do the final review, provided him with some names of some area vet-friendly employers who were hiring, so that he could pursue setting up interviews. I believe he set up those interviews. Again, this is an ongoing case, so when there is that follow-up that's going to occur, hopefully we'd be wishing him congratulations on finding the job. If not, that counselor is going to be there to continue to work with him to find that job. And more importantly, he now has this relationship with his counselor because, as you know, that stress level is going to go up if his employment continues. His finances are going to continue to be more crunched. The stress on him, the stress on his family. And all during this, the counselor has been able to assess and talk to him and build that relationship around what his stress is, as well as providing them those resources. And so that's a key piece for us, is to be able to do both of those things, the counseling as well as providing those resources. So the key piece of our program is our staff. And we have a very seasoned, experienced staff. All our counselors are master's level or above. And I think it speaks to Cascade and our passion for what we do that our counselors' average tenure with Cascade is 9.5 years. So they're very experienced. Training is a very critical component of our program. Certainly with their master's and their licensure there, they have gotten extensive clinical training, but we also provide ongoing training. So in terms of crisis intervention, we use evidence-based training based on the recognized practices put forth by the National Suicide Prevention. We do ongoing clinical training on post-traumatic stress, military sexual training, substance abuse. And so that's a very important piece. We also have two full-time vets on staff, Doug Kuhl, who introduced himself, and he's a director. He's in charge of that outreach and promotion, which is so critical. But there are times when, in his role, he gets vets who want to talk to him and reach out to him because they have his name. So he's been trained as a peer counselor and has been trained and assessed the applied suicide intervention skills training. But we also have a master's level counselor who's a combat vet as well and provides that counseling. And we also have access, and he works full-time for Cascade Centers. And we also have access to 10 salaried master's level vet counselors available if needed. Because there are times when a vet calls in. Excuse me, when a vet calls in, he or she just wants to speak to a vet, and that's understandable, and we'll make that happen. So I've said most of the things that are on this slide. The suicide prevention is an important key piece of this program, and it's a critical service for us to be there in times of that crisis. I think one of the things that sets our program apart is we do have those master's level counselors who can not only provide that critical de-escalation and crisis intervention in that moment, but also during that can provide that clinical expertise and that clinical assessment and deal with those issues for counseling around marital issues, substance abuse issues, post-traumatic stress, and really work with that person around all those issues that are going on. Provide that counseling as well as the crisis intervention and provide those clinical assessments around what further treatment is needed. And that's a very strong piece of our program. So we provide that de-escalation, that intervention, the assisted referral, as I talked about, which is very important. We facilitate rescues if needed, and that follow-up is very important. And most of the time with those cases with the suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts, we're doing multiple follow-ups. The other thing that we're very excited about that just happened within the last couple weeks is we've been accredited by the American Association of Suicidology. So that says that we've met their very high standards that establishes us as providing a quality suicide helpline. And so that's an important piece. It shows how strong our program is. So I'm going to turn it over to Doug to talk about the important piece of the outreach and promotion.
Mr. Chairman, co-chairman, members of the board, again, for the record, my name is Doug Kuhl. I'm a resident of Oregon City, and I'm the director of Veterans Outreach for the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline. Focus of my position, for the most part, is really getting recognition and getting our services increasing an awareness out there in the community. Obviously, with our contract, our target market is the National Guard and their service members and their families. So really, the target audience I have is about 17,000 Oregonians. But we also offer our service to all veterans from the state of Oregon and their family members. So pretty large community out there. I have spent a ton amount of time meeting with people individually, one-on-one, giving live presentations, and really just sharing with them what our service is. A lot of people, for some reason, seem to think that it's just two vets walking around with a cell phone and don't realize that, you know, we're an established call center that operates 24/7, 365 days a year. They called us on Christmas, and they got a live person on the first ring. It's not just a couple guys walking around with a cell phone. I've attended all the Yellow Ribbon events that were open to family members. I have, if you look in your packets, we've developed quite a bit of stuff, but probably the number one most popular thing with my target audience are these little magnets. And then the next most popular thing out with the units, and especially the leaders, are our little posters. And they've got the little tear-out thing that you'll see if you look inside your packet. You've got an example of the five different posters we have in there. We've blown some of those up so that they're about cinema-sized poster, and we've set it up so that every armory, every unit in the National Guard has one of those posters that they can post in their own unit. And then we have about 1,500 of these smaller posters that are everywhere. You know, they put them in the bathrooms. They put them wherever the soldiers and service members might be. So that's been very effective. Again, I've done everything I can to meet with as many people as possible over the last few months. Key people that I've met with is obviously the leadership of the National Guard, but I've also tried to go out and meet with community service providers that potentially will refer service members to and their family members to, so that I can get a feel for what they do and they can get a feel for what we do and kind of build a symbiotic relationship with them. And it's been very advantageous to both of us, both parties. Just to kind of give an example of how that has all worked out for me. In this following case, I, through the relationship that I built with the 41st Brigade's family program, also networking with the Oregon Military Support Network, meeting with different veteran service officers, along with just the network that I have with the leadership within the Oregon National Guard. We had a soldier call in to our helpline, and the person was basically just looking for some free mental health face-to-face counseling. He told the counselor that he was having some problems dealing with stress, but that he was currently okay. So our counselor told him, hey, that's no problem. You know, there are a number of services out there, especially through the Returning Vets organization, where you can get this type of counseling for free. And so she emailed him all those points of contacts, and that was the end of that call. Almost simultaneously, I got a call from one of the squad leaders who said that he had a soldier during drill who had exhibited some severe suicidal tendencies and wanted some ways that he could help that soldier. He felt like what they did at drill wasn't as effective as it could have been. So we spent quite a bit of time talking about some things he could do. We talked about how to build a safe plan with, you know, where he could meet that soldier. And together they could develop a safe plan on what to do when the soldier started to feel like he was out of control and in severe crisis. The squad leader also described to me how the soldier had lost his job and he was really having some financial difficulties, wasn't going to be able to pay rent. This was just before Thanksgiving. And so we talked about some resources that were available to him. And right online, we were able to get him to fill out, and the squad leader was able to get all the paperwork to be able to fill out an emergency relief loan. After Thanksgiving, I followed up, called both these individuals, didn't really know that they were the same case at this time. I just thought it was two different cases. But through talking with the family readiness person at 41st Brigade, she described how during drill they had a soldier that had exhibited some suicidal tendencies and named the squad leader that he'd worked under me as a company commander. So I knew we were talking about the same guy. So then I made contact again with the soldier, asked him how he was doing. He felt like he was doing okay, but he did mention that he had a major episode during Thanksgiving, and that his squad leader was able to help him intervene, and they were able to, they actually ended up calling 911 and got him the support that he needed. Otherwise, if they hadn't have developed that safe plan, probably he would have executed himself. Over the last 9 weeks, I've probably made contact with that squad leader and the soldier at least weekly. And over this period of time, we've been able to get that soldier about $2,100 in emergency relief loans for himself and his family. The soldier's been meeting regularly with Don Weber and the reintegration team. They've developed also a relationship, and the soldier now has an active ability to go out and seek jobs. He's, through Don Weber and myself, we've got him to build a great resume, worked with him on some coaching, and he's able to now go through an interview fairly successfully. Additionally, we've linked him up with some other support through the Family Assistance Program, and the Family Readiness Support Program's given him about $50 in gift certificates for getting groceries about six times now. Yesterday I said it was about four times, but looking back at the notes, it's been about six times that he's completely run out of money and had to go out and get these gift certificates for food. So hopefully it's apparent through this example that, you know, without these programs and without all of us working together, this probably would have had a much different ending. Other things that we use, we have a pretty active Facebook page. We have a PSA that we're working on with the National Guard that we have the draft out on our YouTube channel. All of our brochures and pamphlets all have the little QR code that you can see on this paper that would link them back to our website or back to our Facebook page. And so we feel like we've got a pretty good marketing program set up, and now we just need to start really executing it. Also, our website has over 200 different resources for our veterans to be able to utilize. So if they feel uncomfortable actually contacting us by telephone, they can reach us through the website. And a lot of times they're able to just go on our website and get the resource they need and go from there. This has been really helpful for the remote locations like Milton Free Water, where our MP company is getting... actually, they're now in country. Some of them are actually coming back already. But Milton Free Water is pretty isolated from the great resources we have in the Portland-Salem area. But through the website, they're able to still link up with all of the resources that a family here in Portland would be able to get. And so the website has really been a great conduit for that kind of interaction with people in a remote location.
So just the final piece I wanted to mention, because it is a piece of the contract, is the suicide prevention classes that we offer under this. They're scheduled and directed at the request of the Guard, and when they decide they want us to hold those classes. They're three-hour classes. The Guard has designated them to be for the family readiness coordinators. And so we work with them on... at evidence-based training that talks about basic problem solving with individuals who might be suicidal, how to identify suicidal ideation, how to help a person address the issue, and then get them to the services they need, just in a snapshot of the class. And so we've done three of those so far. I think there's one more that's going to be scheduled this next month, and then we'll have several more throughout the year that we'll be giving. And that concludes the presentation. We'll open to questions.
Good, we have light.
That was the first thing I was going to ask. Any questions? Comments? Yes. Representative Witt.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious if any of these services are available to the military member's family, mm-hmm. and oftentimes... I think that service may be part and parcel of the problem. Separation and all of that can create family problems. So,
most definitely, Representative Witt, it is open to all family members.
Great.
And we do get calls from family members and serve them. Mm-hmm. And you're exactly right. They're an important piece of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. What's the follow-up piece like? So if somebody calls you... and mm-hmm. walk them through, you know, whatever the circumstances.
Sure.
It
depends on the issue. So if someone just calls us for resources, and so if we get calls, people maybe want a list of counselors in their area, and so we'll ask them how they want that delivered to them. Sometimes we'll give it to them on the phone. Sometimes they want that emailed to them. And if it's just a strict resource retrieval, then we give it a couple days, a week, and we'll call them back depending on the conversation with them. And it's usually one follow-up to make sure that they've gotten to those resources. And even though it's just a resource call, it's important to follow up because sometimes maybe they called people or they hadn't gotten to it yet. And so, and you can check in with them again, but make sure they get to those resources. If it's somebody who's in crisis, That follow-up call might be an hour later. It might be 2 hours later. It might be right the next day, depending on what the plan is and then depending on the intervention and the severity of the situation. And it could be there isn't a set limit, so it's based on that severity. So it could be 4, 5, 6 follow-ups until they're engaged in the treatment or deemed that they're not at risk.
And then, see it in the material or anything.
Sure.
The budget side of this,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how is the funding, you were allocated some funding for this, how mm-hmm. is that progressing and what are you anticipating for future need or
sure.
Are we within budget or you make it through that allotted contract?
We are within budget. The contract was very clear about the elements that were in the program. So we looked at that very carefully and based our bid on all of those elements in the program. And so we will be able to deliver the contract in those within those parameters of that budget.
So the contract is a one-year contract, is that mm-hmm. correct?
It's 1 year, and then they could extend it out, but this contract is for a year.
Okay, and this might be for the private dancer, but...
private, you're keeping demoted.
Yeah, I've been
you walk right into that. So when this contract expires, does it go back out for a full bid, or what is the next piece of this?
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish. Presently, I think we got a 3-year.
4-year. Renewable for 4 years.
4 years, okay. Years. Yeah. That's the extent that it can go without being rebid. Again, the question will be, is there federal monies available to do that? And that's, right now, that's
the million-dollar question.
Possible, but it's not guaranteed by any means.
If federal dollars run out, what is the plan to keep this line or any line in the state open?
Co-chairs, Representative Parrish, we don't have a plan. We had $185,000 in 2009-11 in our reintegration budget from the state, and there were $100,000 was cut out of that. So we basically don't have the resources presently to do that. And even if we did get it, as I said earlier, we couldn't take state money and extend this contract under that. The contracting rules are separate, so you'd have to go out for a new bid.
Yes, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your testimony. And Dr. Marshall, you kind of came in here, obviously, in the low bid process. The big concern of a lot of us was, what are we going to get for that?
Right.
And so we have some concerns. So please forgive me. I just want to get a couple things clear in my head.
Certainly.
For the record, and Colonel Cool, if you'd like to answer this as well. In terms of protocols, you gave a great, very accurate description of how you would handle a call already. Mm-hmm. Is that a protocol, or is that just that they got the right call taker at that time?
No, that is a protocol, and that's the training that we provide our staff.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so if we had any questions from anybody on the outside asking about that, we could either refer them to you, or are those protocols available to us if we wanted to read them, or...
Sure, and please refer people to us. I'd like to invite also anybody, if you would like to come and visit, and I would be happy to give you a tour and show you that and show you how we handle that in the call center with the counselors that answer the calls. But
mm-hmm. Thank you. Follow-up to that?
Sure.
And you answered the question already about the American Association of Suicidology. When I got on their website, they don't have you listed yet.
Because 2 weeks ago was our site visit.
Well, that's great. They still have a partnership, but they didn't. And I want to make sure that mm-hmm. we had that covered. So thanks for supplying that and your entire testimony. How many call takers respond to incoming calls simultaneously as an average, I guess?
In our call rotation, we have every day, we have 11 people available to take calls. 11 counselors available to take calls.
Okay. And follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Would that change during a night shift? Or how is that staffed during the night?
Sure.
And let me just preface this by saying, and I'm a military veteran, but also a former police officer mm-hmm. and a current firefighter. Mm-hmm. Suicide calls are not uncommon in my profession. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, they don't occur during the day.
They don't come in 8 to 5.
And I've been yeah. on the SWAT call where right. it's actually, unfortunately, ended differently. So
right.
I would like to know, how many of those call takers are at night?
Sure. We work with Protocol Services, which is also accredited by the American Association of Suicidology. And so all calls are answered within 3 rings. And for after hours calls, Protocol helps us with those calls. And so they have at least 25 people ready to answer calls at all times. And there's never a recording that you get. It's answered Oregon Military Helpline 24 hours a day.
Okay. And hello, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I apologize. And how do your numbers reflect at this point or compared to numbers of the past? So, in terms of call takers and people referred or counseling given, mm-hmm. as compared, do you have the numbers of the previous bid? Or
I don't have the numbers of the previous bid. We have just been able to, the last month, start promoting the program, so that's one of the reasons Doug is tasked to get the word out about that. So right now we're really at about 5 to 7 calls a week on the military helpline.
And then last comment, I promise. And I think, obviously, you understand the anxiety probably more than any of us, mm-hmm. and that is that, you know, if we can't get a long-term funding for a very needed program, and we can't just say we're going to educate people where to go to get the help without changing it every 2 to 3 years, mm-hmm. We're going to be in worse shape than we are right now. At least now we have somewhere for somebody to call that's looking for help. In the mm-hmm. future, those barriers come up, mm-hmm. and they're going to stop trying.
Right.
So I appreciate your work and your efforts. I wish you the best of luck, and thanks again for your testimony and being here to provide this. Thank you.
If I might, I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
But my first and foremost question is, if we allocated money from the lottery, could we use that money for this purpose?
That's education. And
education? I mean, I know that's stretching.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that there's enough lawyers in here that you could get half of them to say yes and half of them to say no.
Yeah, but if we have 10 lawyers.
You've got to find the right lawyer.
Yes, General.
So if I might just make a couple of quick comments based on the Representative Matthews' questions. A couple of facts that I think have worked very well. A couple of things that worked very well in the past, and like I said, we had I think great service from Oregon Partnership as well. But we haven't had a suicide of an Oregon Guard member for over 16 months. We were one of the highest in the nation. We were second behind Minnesota. So we have also taken on aggressively inside our commands resiliency training. Resiliency training, I think it reflects on what Colonel Cool indicated, where the squad leader is actually identifying things now. Now, 5 years ago, we didn't do that. And so we're trying to teach these certain skills to the lowest leadership levels in our organization so they can recognize, you know, these issues. And so we've got several things going simultaneously, not just one thing. To answer your question, what happens in, you know, at the end of the bid and there's no money left, that's problematic. It's very problematic. We had that situation occur with our Fort Oregon website. We lost the federal money for that. It's shut down. Actually, they've kept it up out of the goodness of their own heart, but it's going to go away because we don't have the money to fund it. And we're looking at solutions internally now, which then we would have, instead of outside contract, will probably be as pretty as some of the things you can get from outside contractors, but systems that we can put on, like Fort Oregon reference places, similar to Fort Oregon, on our servers, so we can at least keep that element alive regardless of the federal funding issues. And we hope to have that in play this year.
Are we tracking it all? Do you know? You know, you said 16 months for an active guard, but what about post-separation? Are you tracking those numbers?
So co-chairs, Representative Parrish, we're not. We don't have the ability to track that. The other comment in that reference those suicides, we did an analysis on over half of them. I think it was around 65% had never deployed, which was what Representative Escobar, what we worked on with in the last session to try to get some better data to track this, to see what's really going on. And I think that you know, that piece would be nice, but we don't have the ability to track them when they leave, unless we just hear about it. And a lot often we do, mm-hmm. but we know it's not 100%.
Remember last session we passed the bill that the county coroners would put into a data bank whether they were a veteran, and if they were a veteran, were they in a combat zone, and if they were a combat zone, what combat zone and what time. Mm-hmm. So we can get some data. Anything else? I have a couple questions. I understand your bid of $103,000, and I understand that you're now, what was it, the you're accredited or certified
accredited.
With mm-hmm. someone? But now, does that mean the individuals, do they have any training to go through, or what? I mean, you know, obviously you're not going to have enough people to do 24/7 if you have $103,000 year round. That's impossible.
Well,
so what you're doing is you're taking people from a different situation and putting them on a suicide helpline. You have to be. And my question is, what kind of training do these people go through?
Sure. Co-Chair Esquivel, you're right. They do go through extensive training. First of all, they are master's level, counselors are above. And we have done provided a 24-hour crisis intervention hotline our whole history. So providing the military helpline is new these last couple months. So the new training has been around the military culture.
So you've had a previous background in this.
Right. Part of our employee assistance service is a 24-hour crisis line.
I see.
And so we've provided that. So we've been doing, and I can tell you about that training too, so we've been doing that crisis training on top of their clinical training for their master's that they receive, which is quite extensive. We use evidence-based practices in the suicide prevention. Part of getting accredited, we have an outside body now that says that we follow these practices, and so they've reviewed our whole training protocol that we have, and so we do extensive training with them around that and ongoing training. So we have we meet clinically once a week, staffing cases, bringing in trainers to train our staff. So it's ongoing on the crisis intervention side as well as the clinical side. So on substance abuse, military sexual trauma, post-traumatic stress, all of those things that also impact when someone's in a crisis as well.
Okay, how do you track your calls? Do you record each call? And do you have that digital? So the general said, okay, Joe Blow here had a suicide situation here. Let's see what Joe Blow, if he called in, and what did we do? And do you have ability to email that to the general?
With confidentiality laws, we couldn't do that without that person's permission.
No, but I mean for your internal information as well.
Right. So we do. We have a database. We have a database that we track all our calls. So when a person calls in, a case is created with as much information as they'll give us. As I said, sometimes they want to remain anonymous. Sure. We're able to. So any call that comes in is made into a case in our database. And that is tracked. So we're able to, and at any point, the guard is able to access that data live. It doesn't have any identifying information in the report that comes out, but it tells how many have called, what their presenting issues have been, certain demographic information in terms of their branch of service and things like that. And so they can access that utilization report at any time.
Okay, but back up here.
Sure.
I ask if you recorded each and every call.
We do record our calls.
Do you use that as a training tool?
We do. We just got that technology this last year where we can record calls. Part of it's customer service and part of it's training where clinicians can access their own calls and bring them in, and we staff cases in that way. Also, our supervisors can review those calls as a way of pulling that into supervision. So we do use that. So that's separate from tracking the calls, which is what I thought you were asking, but we can use it as a training tool.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then the other thing is you store the data. In other words, let's say I called in February of one year and then called you back in October. You can put that information together in a single file?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day, Private.
Boy, that's a free call.
I'll tell you what, General Call, I had a tough day today.
Well, I was a private. I wasn't all that bad a rank, really.
Is that Major General Call, though?
That's.
I'm going to take him the other way.
There you go. We'll take him the other way. Okay, I'm going to close this informational hearing. Anything else that we have? Now, we do have some amendments coming in on 204. But we need to correct some language.
Okay.
So we'll do that at the same time simultaneously when we hear 204. Anything for the benefit of the
Yeah. You know, I had this kind of an epiphany up here. It's too bad we can't allow an organization like the Veterans to run for a political office in like a targeted area. They could probably be guaranteed at least $1 million of dedicated funding each and every cycle. It would just be wonderful.
So we'll just increase
just
our
bring
number.
It up again. That's the ridiculous nature in which we spend our money and where we should put the dollars instead.
Well, yeah, I've always expressed this. It's if we're going to go out and start a war, then we sure better take care of those people.
Absolutely.
Well,
so.
I think that obviously we don't get to pick winners and losers, and we know I think that there is some undercurrent around this suicide line issue going on, and as legislature, we don't get to pick. who gets to do that job. I think the things that we need to think about for, you know, obviously we're not going to, we don't have a bill around this in 2012, but as we look to 2013, that the quality of whatever we establish, what kind of quality we want from that service, we establish that we want to make sure that it is maintained and that people get this access to the service that we need, that we're reaching out to people as best as we can in as many directions as we can, who are not actively tied to the military in some way, shape, or form, and other that, you know, that separated group, the people who've walked out those doors, how do they, you know, make sure that they're accessing these things? And then we find a way to fund it, you know, heck or high water, we find a way to fund it and we just make it a priority and, you know, and we, you know, kind of bust through those walls and silos of there's all this other funding going to all these other things. And I personally, as you know, you talked about the racist kind of stuff, I get really tired of seeing us pit seniors against children, children against veterans, veterans against disabled kids. You know, I don't want to see that for this, particularly in this situation where we're talking about people's lives that are, you know, immediately on the line in a situation where they need crisis intervention. So we have to convince our colleagues of this group that is a viable thing that we need to take care of, and the partisan stuff's just got to go by the wayside when it comes to funding it.
Thank you. Appreciate that input. Anything else?
I'd just like to compliment the chairs and our wonderful committee assistant for putting this together and allowing them an opportunity to come talk to us. I mean, there was a lot of angst in this building about what was going to happen with veterans assistance, particularly in suicide prevention. And I think it's up to us to ask the questions to get to a level of comfort so that we can be out there promoting a program to the veterans that we're comfortable with and that we know is providing the service that's that we found to be adequate, and we want it to be extremely adequate. So with that being said, thanks for your work in putting this together. Thank you.
The only thing that I, as a veteran, saw here that's a red flag is that you only have two veterans that are involved in this. And I don't know, and I'm sure that the veterans in the audience can understand, and the ones here at this dais can understand, is that unless you've been in it, you really don't understand it. I can understand some things that you went through, and you can understand some things I went through, but each one of them's different. But more importantly, we have a tendency to, you know, no matter how much schooling you have, I don't care if you've got a master's degree, you don't understand until you've been there. So it's that's the only red flag I really see here, is that part of it. So hopefully you'll hire some more combat veterans that have been through it that understand it. So, anything else?
Yeah.
Representative Boone, how about the words of wisdom?
The words of wisdom. This is the best committee, I have to say. It really is. Everything in it is positive, and for the most part, you know, that we're doing it. And having been in the, I wasn't in the service, but had several friends in the service during the Vietnam War and lost five friends, and saw how people were treated when they came back. And at that time, I was appalled at it. I know a lot of my friends said it doesn't matter. They're home now, just let it go. But it's just it's a hard thing too, and I just can't believe it took me 40 years to get there. But and thanks to this committee and some of the bills that we've passed, I feel like I've started my atonement for those days. Not that I was ever negative on it, but the fact that I was 19 and I didn't do anything, you know, 18, 19, whatever, when you're just out of high school, and didn't do anything to counteract the ugliness that was greeting my friends when they came back, the ones who did come back. So thank you to this committee for doing that. It's been one of my best committees. We're doing good things, and I wish we could take all the bad out of it, and I think we're slowly helping. But and I'd like to see us get to a full funding of those campus vet services officers, because I just know as more and more people come home from the war zones, they're really going to need that. And we're telling them, go to school, you know, we'll help you get jobs, but you have to have the education to get the jobs. And I look forward to giving them credit for what they've done in their service to us. And instead of making them stop and go retrain for something that they're probably better at than the trainers in a lot of cases, and be able to get back to work and back to their lives here. So thanks to everybody on the committee.
Thanks, Representative Boone. Appreciate the input. Very good. Any other questions? Any other comments? If not so, anything for the betterment of the cause? If not so, adjourn.